Hey, this is Chuck Dixon, and you're listening to Signal of Doom.
Well, you know, for me, the action is the juice. I'm in.
Hello and welcome to episode 37 of Signal of Doom. I'm Dave. I'm here with the main man, Stu. Stu, how are you?
I'm good, Dave. It's been a big Punisher week.
It's been a huge week this week, hasn't it? Look, this week, Stu, the feet have been up. I've had 2 days leave. I've been watching the cricket, reading Punisher, watching Punisher.
This sounds like your fantasy.
Yeah, it is. It's just like, I don't have kind of like, I'm quite self-reliant in this kind of sphere and bubble I'm in now. I mean, if they said to me, Dave, you're going to have to become a professional watcher of Punisher, and then you got cricket and the cricket game, could you accept? And, you know, I'd be like, yeah, sure, that's fine.
I feel like you would do it without the pay.
Yeah, I know, but the action for me, I like the money. You know what I'm saying?
Like the bare minimum, you would take that.
Yeah. But, no, it has been fantastic, and we're going to cover Punisher later in the show on Punisher Playbook. We'll do an entire episode review. In that,
we've also got Punisher as our trade of the week this week.
Yes,
so we doubled down on the Punisher.
A Punisher War Journal by Carl Potts and Jim Lee.
Yep.
Back in the dawn of Jim Lee, I think it's even before he got on X-Men. I think this may be his entry into Marvel. So that's gonna be our trade of the week. I think it came in at 500 and something pages, Stu, over there.
Yeah, it was quite large.
I think I owe Stu a couple of picks after this. I like the way I just kind of casually brought it out, Stu. Here's your reading material.
Yeah, hands me this Bible of a book.
And it is a Bible for me, my friend.
Oh, boy, I don't doubt that. I don't doubt that for a second.
I swear by that. 100%. I'm not a religious man, but the Punisher War Journal.
You'd swear by that one, yeah.
Now, Stu, you may know that I did a bit of moonlighting this week. 3.5 hours on the Batman Universe
podcast.
Yeah. I'm a wanted man, dude. I mean, you know, wanted commodity over here. I'm available to the highest bidder. I mean, that's for sure. And
not even a bidder.
You'll be having noticed, Stu, that I did 3.5 hours with Dusty and also Paul from Batman Universe, and it came online I think yesterday. So I'll put the link up on the Signal Doom page. I've been a bit too busy watching cricket to do that, and you know, that would have taken Stu probably about 2 minutes out of my time.
Yeah,
and, you know, I'm obviously a busy guy.
I mean, cricket has tea breaks. It's a pretty civilized sport.
Quite a lot of breaks, man. But I also had cricket game going.
Of course, so yeah, you did.
Lot going on in my life.
Yeah.
And you know, and I haven't shaved. I've grown the beard over here. Do you like? You know?
I'm watching. I'm liking it. Yeah,
yeah, right.
It's rugged day.
Just laziness, basically.
Just lazy day.
Let's not get carried away. 3.5 hours talking about Justice League with Dusty and Paul. They brought up a lot of good points which I want to dig into. But also, Stu, just before we get into the inner depths of Justice League, the box office results still seem fairly poor in the States, and it seems to be tracking to be coming in behind Coco in second weekend.
Yeah, so going into the Thanksgiving weekend in America, which is typically a pretty big weekend for movie
viewers. And it was anticipated
viewers.
Not to have that larger drop-off. That was what I was hearing a week ago.
Yeah, but now having seen the movie, a lot of critics are slumping it down below Coco, which is a new animated Disney release.
Mm. I thought there's a lot of crossover in the audience. I'm surprised that it's coming in behind Coco.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. But I feel like if you're in that early teenage years... The animated films...
I'm in the early teenage years. I'm seeing fucking Justice
League. I'm sorry, but these animated films are actually fantastic. Yeah, all of them have been fantastic.
I agree. I like Pixar too. You don't get too carried away over there. Like, I love Frozen. I fucking Zootopia. Yada, yada, yada. But if I'm like an 11, 12, 13-year-old, and I hear this Justice League, I'm sorry, I'm going to go see it.
Well, yeah, but we're talking about the second viewers. Like, if you're a fan, you would have seen it last week, right? With the rest of the...
Oh, yeah, but I think...
Opening weekend kind of crowd.
I think there's a little bit of
stuff
on the franchise, and I think that was reflected in the figures. But anyway, I think what you're saying is true. If the critics are saying, or the trackers are saying, that it's going to come in behind Coco, then there's a serious problem.
Okay. I mean, yeah. I mean, who knows if it actually will come in behind Coco. But they're certainly looking at a big drop-off week two.
Well, I looked at Box Office Mojo today, and in today's figures, it is so far on reported figures behind...
Yeah, and I mean, so far it's just cracked the 300 million worldwide in terms of box office.
With a strong Chinese response, am I right in saying?
Yeah, so looking at the foreign markets, it's made 185 of that 300. So like 60-ish percent.
That's high.
Yeah. Which is high.
For and they need weekend. It. They need it. Just like Mummy needed it and Pirates needed it and Transformers needed it, it will need to bleed off the overseas market.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, right now they are not in profit zone.
I heard projections it was going to be a $50 to $6 million loss on the movie.
It could be. I think that's unlikely at this point.
Okay.
The movie cost $300 million to make.
Yeah, but
then you throw in your marketing,
very expensive marketing campaign,
and plus they had a bunch of reshoots and things like that, which do add to the cost.
I think they anticipated $20-25 million on reshoots.
Yeah, so you're probably looking at somewhere closer to $4 to $4.20.
Yep.
Hollywood
accounting at its best.
Okay. So at the moment, they're still $100 million shy of making profit.
It's a problem, Stu. I mean, we did a fairly long dissection of the movie's quality. And we're going to get into a bit more of that because I got in pretty deep with Dusty. I'll tell you one thing with Dusty, man. Like, the man goes in depth. At one point, he spoke for 12 minutes. Like, you think I can talk.
I could do
12 minutes, but I would run out of breath. I've got this bad cough. You know, he did 12 minutes in perfect, just beautiful computer-like voice. And he finished, and I said, Dusty, firstly, you should run for office with that stump speech.
I mean, the man can talk. There's a reason he runs a successful podcast.
He's got, everyone knows he's got the murder board at home. With all the stuff with Batman, he links it all up. The guy's a computer, and he's coming against me. And believe you me, I threw some curveballs. You know what I'm saying? I brought up Amber Heard, Stu. I quoted you a couple of times. I quoted The Signal like 6 or 7 times. The Signal got an answer.
Excellent. Yeah, good.
You know, I did actually throw shade at you. I actually gave you a bit of a pump up because I'm trying to bring people into the franchise.
That's good of you.
Thanks. And
I like that you don't do it when I'm around.
No.
Well, yeah.
It's our banter, my friend. But look, I mean, if you've come over from Batman Universe, stick around because Dusty took us deep at one point. And I was like, man, it was like fully like I was in 60 minutes. Like we were cracking into the actual facts of the matter. And I said to Michelle afterwards, should Signal be going deeper, Stu? And she said, no, people like your lighthearted take. But I feel we can deep enough, Stu. Like, I mean, how deep can you go?
I'm not sure you've got that much more depth, Dave.
I'm not confident I've got
We're barely... depth. We're out of our depth at the moment.
Yeah, I'm not confident I go much deeper. That's my problem. That's what I'm saying. Like, we're going to get down to, like, staring at books and just reading our titles.
Well, we've actually got to read and do research. Yeah. No, thank you.
No, thanks. We draw the line somewhere, Stu.
Yeah, let's just read a title of an article
there
and run from there.
Where Lois came up and I said she was... I think I called her my favourite DC heroine or something like that.
Of course you did.
Or DC character. Something like that. Yeah. I really, really blew her up. Like, because I read a lot of Lois, Stu.
Well, yeah, you do. Favorite DC character. Yeah. That's a push, Dave.
But you know I do love Lois. You know.
That's true.
I've often said that I base a lot of my own investigative reporting style on Lois. You know that. The fearless reporter.
Yeah.
Now, Stu, I want to get into this, though. Okay. So let's assume, without we're not Hollywood accountants, like, without really worrying too much about the thing, but just acknowledging that it wasn't what they wanted. It's a long way from where they wanted to be, especially in the US.
Uh-huh.
So where do you think, Stu, Warners are with their slate? Aquaman's the next movie. What's our vibe on how that will go, firstly? That's my first question to you.
I mean, coming out of Justice League, Aquaman was relatively positive.
Sure.
He was used a little bit as the grunting heavy lifter.
Yeah, the surfer bro kind of guy.
Yeah. So he didn't have huge character moments. What we did see was cool.
He had the one scene with Wonder Woman on the lasso, which was probably his biggest character moment.
Yeah, and that was good. Seeing him in Atlantis was great.
Got a question for you, which Dusty brought up. When he met, what's the name, Mera? Amber Heard?
Mera, yeah.
Yeah, which I, by the way, brought up Amber Heard in our conversation.
Yeah, I'm sure you did.
Is that the first time they met, in your opinion? Have they met before?
Yeah, they've met before.
Okay. I wish you were on the course, Stu, because that was a matter of debate. I had no... Here's a question I had. Imagine asking me this question. Dave, name 5 Easter eggs that no one else saw in the movie. And I had to lead off, and I was like, not my strongest thing. I go, eventually come with, they mentioned the penguin. And someone goes, that was in the trailer. I'm like, yeah, but they still mentioned the fucking penguin, okay? Yeah,
but, legitimate Easter egg, well done, yeah.
I got no Easter eggs at all. There wasn't that many. And you weren't. And I was about to go straight to post-credit. They go, and not including post-credit scenes. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, like, I don't know, fuck.
I didn't think there was a lot in this movie.
Thank you. And there was stuff like people were saying, like, in the first shot, you see Janus Cosmetics or something behind. And
yeah, there is a building in Gotham that has...
Yeah, well...
Janus on it, so I mean that was.
I mean
Easter egg, really?
Yeah, well,
Gotham Skyline—that's just standard, right?
Well, yeah, but I guess it's like when you play Arkham Knight or whatever, there's like Dixon Street and stuff like
that. Yeah, but you're always expecting to go past like Ace Chemicals and...
I think there was an Ace Chemicals as well.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they're so big and iconic with Gotham. I should have
just out there because it's often in there. Because I had no idea. I was like, seriously, how...
You can get away with that sort of stuff, yeah.
There was Ace Chemicals. Didn't see it, guys? Too bad.
Well, that's one of the ones that no one else saw, but no.
do you think, though, Stu, where do you think that Aquaman will go box office-wise? Do you think that this negative... kind of like response, or it's a mixed response to Justice League. Some people really like it, and the more I got into it with the guys, I sort of appreciated parts of it, but it definitely had a mixed response.
Yeah,
And it certainly had a depressed box office response in the States. Where do you think it sits up Aquaman, though? Do you think Aquaman could open big still?
I think Aquaman has a potential to open bigger than Justice League at this point.
Mm.
If they get the right moods in the trailers going, they get it lighter, happier.
Would you agree Justice League had pretty terrible trailers? I never was blown away by the trailers.
The first trailer I thought I enjoyed. After that, it just felt the same.
The closer...
Having seen the movie, I understand exactly why they all look the same, because the movie just had one tone.
The closer we got to the movie, the weaker the trailers became, I felt, with all the battle scenes.
Yeah, it's stuff you'd seen before, and it was the stuff that we didn't want to see in the movie.
The best trailer, I feel, looking back, was the one where Batman went to Aquaman, which was in the movie. I like that scene.
So that was the first trailer where you see him.
I think it was the best one.
And yeah, and I agree.
Yeah, no, it's weird. Because all that stuff with the battle, which was in the movie, was equally flat in both spheres. Oh, yeah, it was very strange.
And there was a bunch of scenes that were in the trailers that weren't in the film.
No lanterns. That was never in the movie.
Yeah, and the stuff with Alfred saying... We've been expecting you or waiting for you or something like that. That wasn't in there.
By that, when people put stuff in trailers, Star Wars do it as well. They put stuff in the trailers that doesn't make the movie.
And Thor did the same thing. There's shots of all the characters on the Rainbow Bridge walking towards Asgard, which isn't in the movie at any point.
That's weird, isn't it? I guess a lot of stuff might just wind up on the cutting floor, like in Mars.
Well, a lot of it. They are shooting these scenes for trailers now.
Got it. Okay, really?
Yeah, so they do actually do like a big hero shot just for the trailer now.
That makes more sense, but the Alfred scene doesn't make any sense to me.
No, that doesn't make much sense.
Like it was foreshadowing Superman, but clearly that...
Yeah, and you kind of saw the corner of red somewhere, and there was a hologram at one point.
Thank you, I checked that. Apparently there was rumors of a hologram of Supergirl.
Yeah, never made it in.
Never made it in. And I feel like whatever that was tantalizing seems to be more interesting than what we got. You know? I had a thought. Did I tell you my thought about Lex Luthor? I forgot to tell you this. And I brought this up on Batman Universe.
I'm lucky you're saving your gold for them.
When you're so in demand, you've got to spread the love around. But okay, so here was my great thought, and you'll like this, because it got no response when I told it to Dustin and Paul. Complete silence.
This will be great.
Complete silence, by the way.
Yep.
Okay, so you know the scene after... Spoilers, fucking kids. Like, I'm so sick of spoilers. Like, this is spoilers, okay? After like, I'm not even apologizing for it. I'm like, fuck it, it's spoilers. Okay, so after the credits scene, okay, Stu?
Yeah.
The second after credits scene, where they go into the prison, all right? And they're going Luthor, turn around and all that stuff. Uh-huh, and they spin the guy around. And it was the bald guy, the old guy.
Yeah.
I thought when in the movie theater, and that somehow Darkseid or something had brought in Luthor, the original Luthor, from another dimension who was fat and bald, like in the comics.
See, when I first saw it before he turned around, I was hoping it was Victor Zsasz.
That'd be cool.
I was hoping to get another like Batman villain as an Easter egg. I know, right?
The guy who marks himself when he...
Yeah, he like tally cuts.
Yeah, yeah. I know him mostly from the games. I think he's in some of the Brubaker stuff.
He's an underused villain in any kind of movie.
Are you talking about him from the Arkham games?
He's been in the Arkham games. He's been all over the place.
He's badass, that guy.
He's great.
Yeah.
He's just a deranged serial killer that cuts himself.
It's the cutting that makes him cool.
Like, yeah, he cuts tallies into his stuff.
He's the opposite of the cutter who's like, "Oh, poor me." He relishes because he just marks it off, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
He's got a running count of how many people he's killed.
He'd be getting up there by this point, I would imagine.
He's got a few hundred, yeah. He's doing pretty well for himself.
So, but that was my thoughts, Joe. I just wanted to share it with you.
I was hoping to see some kind of Easter egg there instead of just old crazy man.
But did you think of that, though? Because the original Luthor looked like that guy. Old, pudgy, bald. That's Luthor in most of the comics, and especially in the 60s and 70s and 50s and shit. And then when they got into the 80s, they still kept the bald guy, and then eventually they've transitioned now. They're taking a lot of weight off Luthor. He's still bald.
Yeah, yeah.
But I thought that's where we're going in my crazy.
I don't know. See, if it were Marvel, you know, it would have been a like Kevin Spacey or a
maybe not
someone
Kevin
who's Spacey actually too. Played.
Maybe not Kevin. That's a bit inappropriate, Stu.
No. Someone who's actually played Luther in the movies before.
Oh, that's a good point, Stu.
You know, like have him turn around and be incarcerated as Kevin Spacey, which I think would be hilarious with today's climate.
But Stu,
have him in the bald cap.
Hilarious, Stu. But I think that unfortunately, with the way Hollywood works, and you know, now that Kevin Spacey's
This was well before the Kevin Spacey thing came.
Yeah, but they're
like they shot this way before.
Yeah, I understand that, but that actually is a that would have been a good that would have been a good.
I would have loved to see just an actor that's played Luther, whether it's in the video games.
Gene Hackman.
A little harder to do Gene Hackman, but
Gene Hackman's alive.
Technically, yeah.
He's alive.
Whether he looks anything like what he did when he played Luther.
Like 50 years ago or whatever.
Yeah, it's been a while.
I don't know, but you can't do Kevin Spacey now, Stu. He's person non grata, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, but only this is well after shooting the movie. When they shot the movie, they could have used him. He was still highly respected.
In the non-controversial environment where before Kevin Spacey was revealed to be what he is, a prick.
But remembering, they shot this film 6 months ago. This is before the scandal broke.
Yeah. No, I understand, yeah. But there's no way. If they'd shot it, they wouldn't have released it.
I reckon it actually would have fit pretty well. Having Kevin Spacey turn around as Kevin Spacey, just in jail for some weird reason.
Wow, man.
I thought that would have been great.
Dude, you're out there tonight, man. I like this kind of material you're bringing. It's controversial, but I like it. It's edgy.
I just like Kevin Spacey behind bars. I just like that thought.
Okay. Well, that's where he fucking belongs. No, frankly, you're like, I'll go out and say this. I can't understand why these guys haven't been arrested yet in real life. Like, Harvey Weinstein, they're talking about closing in on arrest. How the fuck are you allegedly allowed to have done all this stuff with underage guys and boys and stuff?
I think, unfortunately, the problem with these mega celebrities is that people want fame and they're willing to lie and say that they were abused to be connected to the story and have that
fame. But I believe a lot of these
reports. Oh, look, absolutely. And I think most of them are going to be legitimate claims. Unfortunately, there's going to be one or two people that try to make these claims just to get 15 minutes of fame.
Sure, but...
And we've seen that in scandals before. Like, when Tiger Woods was revealed as that cheating guy, and he had all those porn stars and mistresses that got, you know, turned up all within a week, a bunch of them were just fake news. You know, women that just wanted to get their face on the paper.
There's smoke, there's fire, and I certainly believe that Kevin Spacey has...
Oh, look, he's absolutely guilty. There are plenty of legitimate claims in there.
I mean, I wonder if they're closing in on...
I think the problem is that they've got to spend some time to make sure they separate...
Yeah, got it.
Because if they put one claim in there legitimate,
yeah.
The defense is just going to rip them apart, show that the whole case is faulty.
Well, I know with Weinstein, the cops have said they are closing in on an arrest.
Yeah.
Good.
It's a matter of time.
Fuck that.
Let's be honest.
Oh, yeah. Let it be a slow, painful death as well. Uma Thurman came out and said that. She goes, I'm glad it's not going to be fast.
Yeah.
You know, you don't deserve a bullet or something. I was like, fuck yeah. Well, fuck it. Like, she'd know. You know, she's worked up close with him.
Numerous occasions.
He's a monster. I don't give a fuck. What's he to come after me in the signal? Fuck him.
You're not his type, Dave. Sorry.
Jesus. I mean, who was the guy, dude, that fucking comedian who Louis C.K.
by
some, whatever. I don't give a fuck that I said it wrong. But like, making... what was his thing? He masturbates in front of women. I can't think of anything more revolting than having to watch
calls him into his dressing room.
And you're like... I'd be like... What?
I don't care how funny you are on stage.
Couldn't give a fuck. Like, I've seen your act. Yeah, you're passably funny, but I mean, you're very replaceable as well. I didn't think it was anything amazing.
Yeah.
I guess this is what makes these people so fucking nuts, but I just can't understand how they think anyone else wants to see that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there's no turn on factor there at all. I mean, could the guy would struggle to be, you know, less attractive than he already is. I don't know where we got into this topic from, but Stu, I like your edgy kind of zany wacky stuff over there. I do appreciate what you're saying, though. That would have been cool to have. You're saying have a previous Luther actor.
Well, just and the Easter egg.
What, dude? What about
whether it's a previous Luther actor, whether it's Victor Zsasz,
who played him in Smallville? Turn around.
He's still around. He's still doing
Rosenbaum.
Michael Rosenbaum. He was voicing the Flash in the animated movie.
I guess the confusion would be, Stu, this is where people would get confused. They're like, so what is that? The problem would be, like I was in the thing, I was thinking, is this Luther? Well, it's not. It's just a... Do you think... Here's my question. Was it a coincidence that it was an old bald guy? Or were they doing a bit of a throwback to the Luca back in the day?
I think they literally just wanted a bald man that wears the same suit and was roughly the same shape.
Okay, so you don't think they were doing, like, here's a tribute to the 60s?
No, I think there was a chance for them to do an Easter egg, but I think it would have been more obvious.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If okay. it was anything better. Like, he would have been wearing a name badge that said something, or...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you know the Luther I'm talking about, who was up in the prison greys and stuff.
Cause yeah, yeah, yeah. Prison.
The mad scientist Luther, I think he was, back
yeah,
before
exactly.
the 80s. When
the crazy genius Luther.
Yeah, back in the 80s, they changed that to a more corporate genius. But back in the 60s, 70s, and 50s, and I guess 40s, he was more of a, like you say, mad scientist kind of guy.
Yeah.
And he was offered in the prison greys because that's where Constantine Superman would put him in prison, yeah. sadly. He was a bit more beatable back in those days, wasn't he, just with his kind of schemes.
I think most villains were. Most villains have kind of stepped it up a notch since, like, the 60s.
Because that was sort of like, the moral of this story, kids, is don't be a bad guy. Like,
yeah, it was meant to be, like, a one-and-done type thing. And then in the 60s, they started going to longer format stories. The villains started getting a little more involved.
We should do, at some point, some sort of classic Superman stuff, just because we're not naturally there, just to give it, you know, check something out along those lines. Like, a good storyline from those days.
Well, that's the thing. There aren't any long storylines. It's like one or two episodes, and that's it.
Okay. Well,
so it's small issue, we'll little mini runs.
Episodes, then. We'll do one or two fucking episodes, then, Stu. Like, Jesus Christ. Like, I'm saying we'll do some classic Superman. I'm sure they did something. It can't just have all been one-shots.
It's pretty much one-shots.
I can't wait until I look and there's a three-parter or something. Like, I'll find it.
When you're looking back in the 40s, no,
the
not 40s, really.
40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. Somewhere.
Oh, come on, that's not classic.
Somewhere.
Just like a 50-year reign.
Back.
Yeah, sure.
I'm not talking like Dawn of Time shit. I can't stand that stuff. Like, oh, look, it's the original stuff that came out in 1940. Snorville from me.
See, I'm talking about like the 40s stuff.
Okay, so 40s, I agree with you. It's going to be like... Yeah, it would be a one-comic deal.
Yeah.
Like, you saw it back in the day, the kind of classic days, like Chuck showed on his pictures and shit, where the kids are lined up, you know, and they're like, cost a penny or whatever.
Yeah.
Hey, dude, that's its own thing, I guess. Maybe I shouldn't be so quick to cast judgment. But that, no, would, like, be, that would be me.
You get little runs in the 60s that worked really well.
For me, 60s
DC doesn't hold much appeal.
Mm.
Like, I've read a bit of classic Batman, classic...
We've done Justice League. I like that.
Yeah.
But more 70s as well that I've read.
Yeah, it was closer to the 70s.
Okay.
Like, I have read the original Run of Justice League where they fight Starro in, like, episode 1.
Yes, we did that. We did it on the show.
That was a remake, though. That was the retelling of the original story.
Was it really?
Yeah, done, like, 15 years later.
Well, you learn something every day.
Same villain. It was an origin story, but it was redone.
Oh, I thought we did the original.
No.
I thought that's how we kicked off the signal, man.
No, it was a reshoot of the same story, same origin story of
just like a
Justice League
retelling of it.
Yeah,
Justice. I'll tell you something that Drew Geraci, the Marvel Encyclopedia, has said to me that we should do on the show Justice League. I believe he said 200 because in 200, what happens is I'll give you the pitch. George Perez and a whole cavalcade of like artists and writers and stuff. Like, it's a big, you know, bumper issue. We might even do it for next show.
Yeah.
Okay, get this. So, the original story of Starro, the Conqueror, and all that kind of shit that happened to form the Justice League.
Mm-hmm.
This is, like, by issue 200, so it's a whole separate group of Justice Leaguers, you know, who make up the Justice League. So, I guess you've got your Black Canary and God knows who else, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, brains get wiped. I think Starro or someone comes back, and the original Justice Leaguers have amnesia and don't realize that they've since disbanded and left the league. And so they're fighting something, they're fighting an original case they thought, you know, had started back in like 1960, and they're coming back like 10 years later, and then they've got the new leaguers who are teaming up with them to defeat it, and the original leaguers don't actually realize that all this time's passed, because they've got amnesia or something. So it's kind of like a nice meeting of the two.
Yeah.
So apparently it's a really cool issue, and like was quite big at the time, considered quite a high watermark of Justice League. And anyway, Drew Geraci said we should definitely read it. But I think it's on Comixology, dude, for like 99 cents or something. So,
yeah, and especially this weekend with the Black Friday sales.
Yeah.
There's a lot of sales going on.
There's a massive sale, Stu, going on for DC. It's absolutely crazy. Have you looked at some of the sales on Comixology, Stu?
I know that Marvel had, I think, 70% off across the board.
Stu, get this. Everything on DC, every single trade that they've got online, I think it's all $5. So you're looking at stuff. Oh, some of the stuff, dude, is like $45 or $35.
Yeah.
Normally, it's $5. I'm actually going to make some buys after this episode.
I mean, even the cheaper trades are normally going for $20, $25.
Yeah,
bucks.
Yeah, and they're all $5. Like,
it's all $5. That's amazing.
Kids, you can really make a fucking killing. Like,
Yeah, and this is a great opportunity to fill in blanks in collections and
exactly.
build up a bit of backstory.
Exactly. You know, and, it's not costing you a fortune.
No.
We were going to promote it later in the show, but I'm so glad you mentioned that, Stu. Now, Stu, I've got another question for you about Justice League. Here's my question to you. Can Jake Gyllenhaal save the Batman franchise?
As a new Batman, yes.
Mm. I think Matt Reeves.
Yeah, he is a talented actor. He's got the body, he's got the physique.
He's got,
he's got everything going for him.
He's got the eyes. He's got it all.
He's got everything
going
for him. He's
quite the package, ladies. Southpaw, End of Watch, yep. Nightcrawler.
Plus his sister was in the Batman trilogy, so he's in the family.
Yeah, Maggie Gyllenhaal, she was in... Didn't she replace Katie Holmes?
She did replace Katie Holmes, yeah.
Hmm. She's a fine actress as well, and it would be a nice nod, actually.
Yeah, look, I think Jake Gyllenhaal's more than capable of resurrecting this franchise with Matt Reeves at the helm.
Jake Gyllenhaal will come with a huge price tag. That's the one thing. Warners will be like, he will want big money.
But I think he can demand it.
No, I agree. I totally agree.
He's in a position now to demand pretty much whatever he wants.
Yeah, they need him, I think.
And I think assuming they get this reboot right, and they get the mood and tone changing, I think they need to go far out with one or two movies before the reboot. They need to really push it out in Aquaman or before Flash. Okay. So something that...
Maybe Wonder Woman 2, Stu?
Maybe Wonder Woman 2.
They're already... If she's writing scripts and developing that, she must have some idea of where she wants it to be. So if Wonder Woman 2 comes out before Flashpoint, then they can do any corrections they want to do in Flashpoint. I think you brought that up.
Yeah, but I feel like they need some kind of market tester. Because at the moment, all their movies feel like they're the same.
Hmm.
So they need something that's way out there.
Yeah.
Just to test the waters and see what works and what doesn't. So when they do Flashpoint, they can absolutely nail the characters, how they want it to run, whether it's going to be dark and gritty again, but just in a different way.
I mean, Batman, I don't mind the fucking Batman movies being dark and gritty, like a moody or whatever. Like, he said he wanted to do a film noir, Batman. I'm like, hell yeah, bring it on.
Yeah.
I mean, it suits Batman, you know? That's a great idea.
Yeah, it does.
I've got another question. Do you think that you'll still have Batfleck doing it, like, as the older Batman, potentially? And so,
I mean, there's potential for multiple universes to run at the same time.
Yeah.
So you could have crossovers with big Justice League events where you get, you know, both versions of Batman showing up and two versions of the Flash and...
Yeah.
Like, you could have that as a separate crossover event, which works really well.
A lot of people really like the TV Flash. A lot of people like the TV
Flash. Yeah, I'm one of them.
Yeah, I like it too. Like Michelle, girls at work, they've all said, oh, how come it's not the TV Flash?
Yeah.
Could you not have, in a multiverse kind of Flashpoint movie, have TV Flash turn up for a second? I think you could.
I mean, they certainly could. They've got the potential. I mean, Warner owns everything. I think the problem is, if you run those two universes together...
Mm.
You start running the risk of having actors demanding to be on the big screen when they're only on the small screen.
Sure, yeah.
Some of the guys that are in The Flash and Arrow and Supergirl start saying, well, you know, they crossed over, why can't we cross over onto the big screen?
Well, and they have no problem saying no so far. I'm sure plenty of, like, Green Arrow, whatever his name is, had pushed for years to try to be Green Arrow in the movies, and he's got a polite no, it's not happening.
Yeah, so I think they've just separated the two completely.
But it just feels like in Flash with a multiverse thing, it seems like a pretty easy leap of logic that you could potentially have Grant Gustin, I believe his name is, like running by Ezra Miller or something like that.
There's no reason why you couldn't. I just feel like practically it opens up a bunch of doors they don't want opened.
Suddenly you're getting the chick, whatever her name is, who plays Felicity saying, why can't I be in the Batcave, etc.
Yeah.
I would say to Felicity, you're more than welcome in the Batcave, personally. But that's just me.
And there we go, yeah.
Stu, how happy are we that Zack Snyder has left the building?
I feel like it's under incredibly unfortunate circumstances.
Oh, sure. But his presence not being
but
there.
But I feel like him not directing the next few movies is a good thing for the DCU.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic thing. I think a lot of the stink, I'll be honest, I think a lot of the stink over the franchise has come because of Zack Snyder's visuals haven't meshed with what the audience wants, the critical audience.
Yeah, and look, we've said it before. I think Warners did the right thing backing somebody to lead it.
Sure.
And they showed a lot of guts letting someone take this much creative control.
Yep.
I think it worked well for Marvel. They happened to hit on Joss Whedon early on.
Sure.
And he ran the show and he ran it really well.
Yep.
They've now passed the torch onto the Russo brothers,
exactly,
who are running the show at the moment, and they seem to be doing a really good job.
But it still comes down to how you execute.
And it's just unfortunate they picked Snyder, who has a very distinct style, and it's polarizing with the audience.
That's very good point, Stu. Like, I mean, I enjoy Watchmen, his Watchmen movie. I really do enjoy it as a film. But Watchmen is an inherently dark comic, you know?
It is, and he does have good films. Like, I really enjoyed his 300.
Dawn of the Dead.
Dawn of the Dead is fantastic. Dude,
I actually really enjoyed a lot of Zack Snyder, but his DC Universe stuff has never really fully connected with me. You know, and I'm someone who really has liked a lot of his previous movies. I think that Zack Snyder is a very good filmmaker, but I don't think it's meshed that well with his universe.
Yeah, so for me, I feel like if he'd done a Batman film instead of a Superman film,
sure,
we'd be having a different conversation.
Good point.
Because the way he did Batman was really good.
I agree.
In Batman v Superman, when they used him in that warehouse fight, it was fantastic.
I read on the internet that apparently the opening scene in Justice League with Batman is a Joss Whedon scene. You know, the opening scene
doesn't
moving around.
I mean, it certainly felt different to the Snyder.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was a good scene. But I also heard reported that the Aquaman lasso scene was a Zack Snyder scene. So it's interesting how it's not always what you'd predict.
Yes, yeah, I wouldn't have picked that one at all.
No, but apparently, reportedly, it was. So it's just funny. Sometimes as an audience, this whole thing of guessing what scene is who, we don't always get it 100% right by going by our preconceptions. You know, it's just interesting.
Yeah,
because I don't think many people would have picked that as a Zack Snyder original scene, knowing that Joss Whedon had come in to do character moments and yada, yada, yada.
No, but having said that, I think it was hard to pick a scene that was a reshoot or not. Mm. And I think that's credit to Joss Whedon, who did exactly what he wanted to do, which was make sure the scenes that he reshot felt like a Snyder scene.
Yeah, meshed in.
And it flowed well. And okay. I think credit where credit's due, he made it flow.
Oh, yeah.
It was in the wrong direction, but it was smooth.
I think if you inherit a movie where obviously one guy's done so much work on it, even though it's unfinished, it's incredibly hard to turn that movie around completely. Like, yeah. you're window dressing around the sides, really, honestly. Yeah. Stu, another question for you. And I like the way I'm posing questions to you, Stu.
I mean, it feels like I'm being interviewed, and I'm not displeased. No, I'm enjoying this.
Good.
What else you got?
Can Geoff Johns turn the entire universe around, and does he even have that power? I'm talking about, obviously, the Warner's universe, not the universe itself.
So is Geoff Johns a god? No. Maybe. I don't know.
A lot of his comics. He's a comics god.
Yeah, maybe.
You know what I mean, though? The fucking Warner's DC universe, which apparently he's now heading or running or whatever he's doing.
I think after this episode with Snyder, Warner's is going to be a little more reluctant before giving full creative control to any one person.
Really? But I would have thought that's more with directors. I still think you need someone at the fucking controls.
You do need someone, but I think it's worked better, especially in Marvel's case. I think that's what they're running off at the moment.
Sure.
In that they've got someone to tell them, we need this character to end here, and we need these characters to end up here. You've got free range of everything else.
No, I hear what you're saying. A big picture guy.
I think they need a big picture guy to connect all the dots, but they also need their directors to have major kind of control, critical control over what they're doing.
But Stu, how does that tie into, though, this point here that the Warner CEO said after the film was shot and they're coming to reshoot it, it needs to be under 2 hours. That's a problem. A movie's been shot. You know, if they'd started filming and go, this needs to be under two, but they've shot, let's say they shot close to 3 hours, which is probably what they shot. They probably shot a movie that was going to be about 2 hours and 50 minutes. And then it's like, not only do we lose the director, but we bring in another guy and we go, it needs to be under two. That's a huge problem.
It is.
Like, and see, that's coming from the top of the fucking company.
Yeah.
I think that was a mistake. I'll be honest. I mean, look, I'm sorry if this affects my chance of getting a job with Warner's, but believe you me, I can backflip on this if it comes down to it. I don't believe it that strongly. No, but I think that's a real impediment to the storytelling once so much of the movie's in the can. Because you then start trimming, and they trimmed a lot out of Justice League. You could tell they trimmed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they really did. There was a lot of character moments that just weren't there.
It was cut to the bare bones kind of thing to keep the story propelling, which, and it kind of worked to propel the story, but it left a lot of emptiness as well.
Yeah, it kind of felt like they'd looked at their formula sheet and said, movies that are 2 hours long do better critically.
Yeah.
So make it 2 hours long because then it will be better.
I just think that was a problem. And what I'm saying is, like, okay, that's the big boss who said that, and they did it. okay. But I hope, you know, remember when we heard it was going to be 2 hours, both of us said, gee, I don't know. Because I just feel that you've got so many characters.
Yeah.
If you want to have any kind of decent story, and dude, look at all these Justice League here that on the shelf. There's decent stories within. If you're going to have any sort of decent story, you need some running time because of the amount of characters.
Oh, yeah.
And that was my biggest... And so when we got the very stereotypical comic book story, when I was in the cinema, I wasn't at all surprised. Because I was like, yeah, you need A to B to C. Because you got no more time to have anything else but that.
Yeah, exactly. There were no plot twists, no surprises.
It was paint by numbers. Surprisingly disappointing villain.
Yeah. No, it was very paint by numbers.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for me, it's just thinking of the constraints of place on the editing process of the storytelling. Because, I don't know, something else as well, Stu, because we're going in quite deep here, but a lot of this was sort of was stuff that we were talking about on Batman Universe, and then I was just thinking about afterwards, and I was listening to John Snipp on Collider. He was saying about a good point I felt about the marketing failure of Justice League. I thought the trailers were poor, as we've said, but the complete absence of Superman. He was saying, why wasn't Superman front and center in the marketing? And the more I think about it, the more I think that's what's going to get the mums and dads bringing their kids in. Like, seriously. No, they like... People might be wishy-washy on actually Superman in the comics, but the S symbol does sell. You know what I'm saying? Like,
look, it does. It's one of the most recognisable symbols.
Thank you.
Other than the Batman logo.
Yes.
Like the 1989 classic Batman logo.
And the Wonder Woman one's getting up there, but Superman is big.
Wonder Woman, it's nowhere near Batman and Superman. No, but it's Superman sells.
Yes, that's my point.
Other than the Batman logo, Superman logo is the most recognisable logo in comicdom, let alone DC.
I totally agree.
It's more recognisable in the DC or Marvel logos.
I would say Batman and Superman logo-wise are the two biggest things in comics.
Yeah, their branding is better than any other property DC own. Yeah. Why they didn't cash in on that in their own marketing campaign doesn't make sense.
Because it was no surprise he was in the movie.
Yeah.
It was quite reported. See, I think that was a mistake. And I'm surprised that the marketing gurus do, because these guys get paid squillions. Mm-hmm. They get paid, like, dude, probably millions of dollars.
I mean, put it this way. It's like someone like Coca-Cola, which is such a recognizable brand worldwide,
yes,
not using their logo in an ad.
Yeah.
They can make a fantastic ad, but unless it ends with their logo, people don't connect that concept with that brand.
Yep.
When they're watching these trailers, they need to connect things that they know and care about.
Mm-hmm.
Things like the Superman logo, Batman logo.
And, dude, look, here it is on my mouse pad.
I mean, it's everywhere. You can't escape
it. I'm not a big Superman fan, but I like the logo and Superman there looking so heroic.
Yeah.
You know, why not? It's a yes.
This needed to be branded very early on as a superhero film, which is light.
Yeah. So I think that was a mistake, and I think that cost them a bit of the box office, because all these little things impact on box office. We're dealing in such big numbers here that a certain percentage missing, like 20% missing, it actually really hurts the big number. You know, we're dealing in big amounts here. So these little shifts.
I mean, their attempt was to hide this character as a surprise reveal.
But it was no surprise.
Now, Marvel had done this previously with the Vision. They kept the Vision.
But no one cares about the Vision.
And that's the big difference.
Yeah, like, fuck the Vision.
Like they kept the Vision secret, and it worked for their marketing campaign. That there was a surprise character that no one saw coming.
Sure.
And it was a plot twist in the movie.
The only people who care about the Vision are the people who saw him in the movie after that happened. You know, like...
But with Superman...
The audience is tiny.
They couldn't use it as a plot twist. It was so obvious and so flag-posted that it wasn't a plot twist. It wasn't a surprise. And at that point, they just lost...
I guess so far as to say I'd like to see a picture of Superman on a fucking hill waving the American flag. Like, or holding the American flag. You know, the classic Superman pose kind of thing. Like a silhouette or something of him. Something. Give me something and then show the S. Just for that feeling of Superman, that feeling, that mixture of sort of pride and patriotism and God knows what else and hope, that's what Superman is.
What I don't get is they've got a bunch of posters with the other five characters kind of standing there staring down the lens of this camera. Exactly. Why don't have Superman just flying in the background, the sun behind him?
That's exactly it, Stu.
Just have the S visible. Don't even worry about his face. Don't worry about any other details.
Yep.
Have the S flying above them with these, you know, sun rays behind him.
Yeah.
Just showing that he's kind of there. He's this figure looming over the Justice League trying to help him out.
And it's a feeling of hope. Him
exactly.
Flying. Yeah. I was going to say this, Drew. I kept thinking, I thought this in the movie. I actually thought this to myself. I sort of thought our cynicism as a world has killed Superman. Because we are so used to it. We like that dark and gritty. How many times do we hear it? Like the dark and gritty. Uh-huh. Like the Snyder, dark and gritty. We made Superman so dark and gritty in Batman, Superman, and Man of Steel, you could barely recognize him. And it's almost like Warner's, though. We've killed him, but Warner's are burying him in this franchise. And the more I thought about it, I just kept thinking, people at Warner's, like the directors, the producers, you know what they need to do? They need to look at some key scenes in Superman 1, yeah. like Christopher Reeves. And I'm not sitting here saying you need to mimic those movies perfectly. I know they're dated, but what isn't dated is the feeling that Superman brought to them.
Yeah, but what I don't get is dated is in right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I get it.
If you look at some of the biggest critical hits of this year...
Mm.
Things like Stranger Things 2 came out on Netflix, which sure. is getting cashing rave 80s reviews, nostalgia. 80s nostalgia.
Yep.
It did way better than expected in the cinemas, 80s nostalgia.
Oh, yeah.
Thor, 80s nostalgia.
For sure, for sure.
Like, I mean, 80s everything
is never far away from nostalgia anyway. Every now and then we really tap
in. Exactly. And right now, this year, it's been the perfect scenario
yeah.
to get a bit of lighthearted 80s fun.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Like, we're going back and we're looking at the careers of some of the great musicians that were huge in the 80s that unfortunately died in the last year or two.
Like David Bowie.
Like we're seeing David Bowie and Prince that were in Leonard Cohen. I mean, David Bowie and Prince were both in
Tom Petty?
Justice League.
Yeah.
There was pictures of them on the front page of the newspaper.
Yeah.
Like, why not tap into some of that and have a lighthearted 80s
Remember Prince Superman Bat Dance from Batman.
Do you remember? The Joker coming down
there. Yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah.
I loved it, man. That's what I got into Prince. Yeah, look, it just feels...
Go like, with it. Run with the nostalgia. Go with a lighthearted 80s feeling film.
If you're going to embrace Superman, you've got to embrace some of his corny old-fashionedness. That's what makes him Superman.
I feel like they're worried that it's going to be too silly and corny.
Who cares?
And they need something that's more grounded in reality, and I don't think that fits with Superman.
Yeah, Superman...
Superman is meant to be fun and a little bit silly and out there. He has underwear on the outside. He wears a cape.
Yeah.
Like, nothing is serious
there. He's kind of cheesy. That's him.
Exactly.
Like, it he works, believes it. Though. He believes... Yeah, it works. Yes, it works.
He's naive at points. He's so over-the-top,
good God, dude,
Boy Scout kind of character.
There are people in life like that, though.
It works.
And people like that kind of thing. And the thing about Superman is he doesn't lie. You know, Superman actually is like the politician who actually does tell the truth. He's the exception to the rule.
Yeah.
That's the whole point of it. And what's hilarious is... I'm saying this, and Stu, I don't think... I probably own, out of all my entire comics library, maybe two Superman trades, which I picked up at incredible discounts. I'm not his biggest comics fan, but I recognise what makes him work. And those movies, I saw them as a kid, and I love them. You know what I mean? Like, they were fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Henry Cavill is such a good actor, and he looks so good, and you know he can do the role.
Yeah, when they're not messing with his face with some CGI,
yeah, you've got to.
He looks amazing.
You've got to give him the scripts and the shots to really let it flow.
But like, I'm just let it go a little bit wacky. Don't let them do another Zod, do another Luthor. Like Luthor and Zod are so grounded in reality.
Sure,
they're both they've both thought about it. They're tactical. They've planned this out. It's A, B, and C.
Yeah.
Let him come against someone a little more wacky.
What about Brainiac and Bottle City of Candor?
I love Brainiac as a villain.
Yeah, Brainiac with his miniaturizations. Like, it can still be dramatic.
Yep.
I mean, he's miniaturizing worlds. He's miniaturized Candor. As far as I'm aware, Stu, and correct me if I'm wrong, has at any time in Man of Steel or Just League Candor been mentioned? Have we gone to the fortress and seen the Bottle City of Candor? Has that happened in the movies?
Not in the movies. We've seen it in Smallville. They talk about Candor.
Yeah, well, it's not in the movies. What I'm saying is Candor
nothing in the DCU.
In Superman.
Absolutely.
Like, do that. And it can be dramatic. And it's all about Superman. It connects to Krypton. It kind of writes itself. This is where I
And like you and I were talking before the show, this is the perfect time to do that. Definitely. Superman's just come out of the ground. He's fresh out of the grave. He's got a little bit amnesia.
He's all bright, though, and stuff now, you know. Like.
But this is when he needs to go on a soul-searching mission, go into space.
Yep.
Run into Brainiac.
Yeah.
One of Brainiac's like scout ships.
What about Mongul as well? Do you know that one?
Yeah, there's plenty of
the
like
War World,
a little bit stuff. Of wacky villains out there that work really well.
Some of this stuff I feel can be solved by like seriously, Hollywood. Go and watch like Superman animated series. Watch like 5 episodes and you'll get enough material.
And really. Look, I think this is what something like the Flash TV show actually does really well.
Mm.
They've brought in Gorilla Grodd. Yeah. As a recurring villain.
I think it's cool.
It's so out there, zany and wacky, that it just works.
I like the Flash TV show. I think it's pretty good.
It is. You fall into that trap of just going, yeah, let's roll with it. It's fun.
Yeah.
It's I good. Don't care if it's not
No, I think it's
realistic.
Really cool. But this is the thing. Like, I've got Mark Waid's Flash Run. I've been reading a bit of it. It's good shit too. Like,
yeah.
Like, there's some good stuff there. You don't always have to, like, pretend it's real. Like,
no, I feel like, just, like, look, don't get me wrong, the Dark and Gritty works in scenarios.
100%.
I think the Marvel Netflix shows,
oh yeah,
all of them, including The Punisher, which we're going to review later,
yes,
the Dark, Gritty, reality-driven villains work really well there.
Agreed. But
because you're given 13 hours to tell a full story, get backstory, understand where these characters come from. In a 2 to 3 hour movie, you don't have enough time to really understand the characters.
Mm.
Dark and Gritty doesn't really work cinematically.
It can work for Batman, I think. Like, there's certain characters it works for, but like,
yes, not, but I feel like the reason it works for Batman is because we know Batman so well already.
Yeah.
The audience is so familiar with Batman that you don't need to spend an hour setting him up.
No. We all know that
you can have a 10-minute scene and set up that he is a moody, grumpy, disheveled Batman that's running on zero sleep.
Even Batman, I feel like we haven't explored, like, at all the full potential of Batman in movies. I still feel we're only scratching the surface. Like,
honestly, I feel like we were getting there with the Nolan films.
We were getting there. But
that trilogy worked for me.
Give me No Man's Land. Give me Nightfall properly. Give me so much. There's so
I would give anything I own to see a proper Nightfall adaptation.
It'd be fantastic. Can you imagine how cool it would be?
Like, that would be amazing.
Yeah, like, there's just so much you can do. Like, that's the thing.
Guys, if you're listening as a side note, right now, with those Comixology sales, things like Nightfall, that's what you should be picking up right now.
Oh, hell yeah. God, yeah. Like, seriously, go and buy. I mean, kids, you know, freedom of fucking choice. Like, do what you like. But if you're serious about listening to the Signal, we've had Chuck Dixon on twice. I've been chatting to him offline, et cetera. He's had plenty to say about the Punisher show. But here's the point. Go and grab the Nightfall. Go and grab the No Man's Land trades. They're all like $5. It's some of the best comics you'll get, and you'll get the whole passage of Batman through the 90s, dude, which is still, to me, still the greatest period for Batman.
For sure.
Like, it's just fantastic stuff. Well, Stu, that's kind of it for Justice League, other than, here's a thought I had. When I was watching the bit where they're talking about the mother boxes, and we gave, you know, some of the mother boxes to the Atlanteans and some to the...
Well, just one. One to the Atlanteans, one to the Amazons, and one to
men. But one to men. Did you get the vibe that was very Lord of the Rings-ish when they were doing the rings? Do you remember? Because they
even... It did feel very Lord of the Rings. And he was wearing that crown that made me think of the Kings of Men.
Yeah,
and...
thank you.
Yeah.
I thought that as well. And I was thinking, though, Stu, and I heard this on Collider, I feel like that almost could have been worth a prologue. A prologue setup might have been the way to go, with Wonder Woman telling the story to Bruce. And she could have narrated the story at the beginning of the story of Darkseid. Like, I'm just thinking of different ways the film could be more entertaining. Would you like...
There's quite a few of them, yeah.
Yeah, but would you have liked that idea of Diana sitting there with Bruce in the Batcave, the fire's on in the background, and she's telling the story to Bruce over with a cup of hot cocoa or something?
I like the idea that Bruce is kind of stumbling across it, and he doesn't know where to turn, so he calls up Diana and says... What's happening? I think an invasion's coming.
But
she basically comes out with, it's already here, let me explain it.
Yeah.
And then you get the whole, this is what happened thousands of years ago.
Yeah. But did she do that in the film?
More or less, yeah.
But I prefer my version, where she's in the robe, in the Batcave, and the fire's on in the background.
I feel like there's a few other reasons why you're preferring your version. I feel like this maybe isn't pure story-driven.
This story, there's a personal story as well. Because from reading the comics, Batman and Wonder Woman have had romantic chemistry before. Are you aware of that?
I mean, that is true, yeah.
Thank you. I believe in DC 1 Million or something, I think they share a kiss or something, but it might be off screen. It's a pretty tenuous link. Batman, Wonder Woman, shippers out there. Like,
it is. There's other more prominent relationships. Unlike
Superman, Wonder Woman, they actually had a series. But there's a series coming out next year. Liam Sharp, who drew Wonder Woman with Greg Rucka, He's writing and drawing Batman Wonder Woman, which is coming out next year, like a co-title. So that'll be interesting.
That'd be good. Yeah. I'd like to read that.
Maybe I should tweet him and say, will there be any romantic subtext? There might be. Both of them are single, technically. If you think about it, he's better get engaged.
Sorry, did you just say Batman was single?
Oh, I was thinking he was single, but I mean,
he is engaged right now to Catwoman.
But haven't I? I've just forgotten all about that.
Yeah.
So maybe...
And he just got permission from the ex, so...
He just got
permission. It's green lights.
So he's not single, Stu.
No, he's...
Even outside of Gotham area code?
He's one step away from being married. It's about as far away from single as you can get.
Don't get me started again on the wedding.
Let's move on.
One second I'm wedding planning, the next second I'm just like already planning his dates with Wonder Woman.
I like that you've already planned his second marriage.
Wonder Woman's not the marrying type. She's not. She's not my friend. She needs to keep rolling. Okay, well, Stu, that was my final point in Justice League. How about this, though? This was a ridiculous rumor. There was a rumor that swept the internet, apparently, earlier this week that Joss Whedon was being sacked from Batgirl.
Yeah.
Because of the underperformance of Justice League. It was proved to be ridiculous and wrong.
There were a bunch of movies that came out basically covering every upcoming DC movie that said it was getting removed, getting cancelled because of the performance of Justice League.
Who starts these rumors, though? Who's the guy sitting there who starts them? Is he just like, I'm going to really set a firestorm here?
I mean, don't get me wrong. I think there is room to move on pretty much every DC property right now.
Yeah.
Based on Flashpoint. Sure. They can do whatever they want.
Okay.
And if that means removing Batgirl from the slate, it's possible.
I could live without Batgirl. Like, I mean, I like
Batgirl, exactly.
But I could live without Batgirl.
Yeah, I'm in the same camp. I think removing Whedon right now is dumb after he's done such good work. But I would keep Whedon
connected to the franchise, like the actual DC slate somehow, if it wasn't Batgirl, something else, you know?
I think the name alone drives people to those movies.
Exactly.
He's worth keeping around for sure.
There is no release date yet on Batgirl, is there?
No, I think they tentatively said 2020.
Okay.
Which was the same year as the Green Lantern Corps movie.
It's a little like, Dave, you have to stay alive for longer just to get through these fucking movies because they can't, like, you know...
Yeah.
It's not like next year. It's like, oh, God, so in 3 years' time, I have to fucking wait for it. Like, give me a break already. Like,
yeah.
Sometimes I'm like... Stu, honestly, I'm like, seriously, in 2018, why am I only seeing one fucking movie from DC? It annoys me. Just the thought of it annoys me. Like, seriously, why can't there be a Superman movie or be a Batman movie or something? Like, how long does this fucking take?
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
It is ridiculous. When the other company, Marvel, is just churning them out.
Marvel's got three due next
and
year.
And it's not like, dude, it's not like they're Academy Award winners. They're just good movies, you know? Like, it's like they've just got the, it's like they've sort of got the mass production going and DC is still doing it by hand. It's not a fair race almost.
Yeah. I mean, not only are the movies a better quality, but there's more of them. Yeah,
the end movie is a lot more pleasurable, like, and box office life does better. So the whole thing.
I feel like Warner's almost got bogged down in the idea that they need to be critically amazing.
Yeah.
Like, the Nolan trilogy won Oscars, and I think that's what they were going for.
Yeah, that's
which wrong. Doesn't work when you're building, like, Ant-Man 15 movies.
Ant-Man was a funny, entertaining movie about Ant-Man. It wasn't winning the Oscars, you know?
It was never going to win Oscars.
No, it was an entertaining movie. No one cared about Ant-Man before, but it made
I think
money.
At one stage, they were like, maybe for special effects, but...
Oh, great.
Like, nobody cares about those tiny little Oscars that's when like, you're so watching like, a superhero movie.
Award winner because it won a...
It know. Did win one for makeup. That was ridiculous.
Exactly, it's ridiculous.
How that is an Oscar-winning film is beyond me.
Yeah, no, that's the one I look back on the most and think that's the one I really don't like. Like, even though I like Margot Robbie and Deadshot, that's the one I think is the weakest, actually, the Suicide Squad movie, to me.
I think as a whole, it is probably the weakest.
As a whole piece. And I love the Margot Robbie bits.
But I think it was because those characters shone so brightly compared to the rest.
Yeah.
That the rest just felt really flat and dull.
Mm, yes. Now, Stu, what about this? Where are you on this? Jude Law confirmed to be the co-leading Captain Marvel.
I love this because he's not only confirmed as the co-lead, he is playing Mar-Vell, the original Captain Marvel.
Oh, your favourite character over there.
Close to it, yeah.
Well, you're a big fan of Captain Marvel, the guy who died of cancer.
I am a big fan, yeah. Okay, all right. I don't know. Favourite,
to me, he's a zero, but I mean, I don't say that purely to annoy you.
He's so proud of himself.
Yeah, I am so proud of myself. I don't think I've ever read anything with Captain Mar-Vell. It's the hyphen that kills me.
Dave can't read hyphenated names.
I just hate the hyphen.
It sounds too foreign.
But, you know, also, Stu, the fact that they had to keep Captain Marvel in print just so DC couldn't have a comic called Captain Marvel.
Yeah, with their Shazam thing.
That is what makes him so extra lame in my books. But so he's playing the original Captain Marvel. That actually at least is cool.
And they're saying that the role in size is going to be similar to, like, Doctor Strange in Thor.
So
where he's in there for, like, a good 10-15 minutes, a couple of scenes.
Okay.
It's a solid cameo, but it's still basically a cameo.
Okay.
So I don't know about co-lead.
I'm excited about the Captain Marvel movie. I seriously am. I'm looking forward to it. Is it out next year?
It is not out next year.
Okay.
Next year, from the Marvel slate, we've got Panther, Infinity War, and then Ant-Man and Wasp coming out at the end of the year. Okay. Marvel comes out early 2019.
Okay.
Followed by the next Infinity War Avengers movie.
Bring on that shit, man.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah. No, I can... Okay, I can live with that because Marvel have got me sort of satisfied.
But, I mean, look, Jude Law and Brie Larson, Those are some serious actors.
Oh, no, yeah, they're acting with gas, yeah, for sure. And don't forget that Samuel L. is going to be back, and it's going to be set in the 90s, and Skrulls are going to be involved.
I mean, yeah, as soon as they say Skrulls, sign me up.
Also, Stu, I don't know if it's in the show notes, but did you read that all that stuff about Fox and Disney, there's a plenty of other studios who are also looking to poach assets from Fox, and that included Sony. So when the news was reported that Fox are looking to sell, other people naturally are interested, other studios. So it could potentially mean that Fox...
I mean, I am interested. What happens... I don't understand the legality of it, but could Fox go and just buy Fantastic Four and X-Men out from under Marvel?
Well, no, they'd never sell it. That's the point. They own those IPs.
Well, Fox owns them.
Yeah, yes.
Could Sony come in and buy them?
Sony, yes. Yes, definitely.
They're not restricted because those deals are still linked with Marvel?
From what I understand from the reports were that Sony were interested in acquiring things like, including the X-Men and Fantastic Four, potentially.
Because it's kind of like with X-Men, I know that there is... Sorry, with Fantastic Four, there is a clause that says if they don't release... Yeah, make and release a movie every four or five years, then the rights revert back to Marvel. Because it's still so linked with Marvel, could they sell that? Could they sell that contract over?
Like, I'm no lawyer, I'm not in the rooms, but the reports were that that's what was being considered. But it was a very vague report, dude. It wasn't
like... I feel like that'd be a giant fuck you to Marvel, wouldn't it?
Well, but potentially that could move... let's just play hypothetical. Let's just say Sony pony up the money and acquire...
They wouldn't sell X-Men.
Well, let's just say they did, for the sake of argument.
Okay, sure.
Okay. That could potentially move an X-Men Avengers crossover a lot closer because Sony's obviously has a deal with Spider-Man where they're relicensing out properties that they bought to Marvel.
Sony and Marvel are certainly more friendly than Fox and Marvel.
That's what I'm saying. If those properties... Let's just say, for sake of argument, Stuart was Fantastic Four. Just for the sake of argument, then yes, I think it's quite likely you would think that they could move closer to a deal because Fantastic Four has been proven to have no box office potential by itself, but hooked in with the wider Marvel Universe, I think it could have some real legs, you know?
Yeah, look, I agree with the idea that Fantastic Four doesn't do well when it's outside of Marvel's hands.
Oh, yeah.
It hasn't. It's never done it.
It's flopped.
It has the potential to be an incredible movie.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they have one of, if not the best villain in the MCU.
If you try to enter the Marvel Universe hard, you could certainly get something good. It could definitely happen.
Look, for me, Galactus. When you've got things like Galactus, Doctor Doom, and Silver Surfer,
thank you.
Those are three of the best characters in Marvel.
Yeah, it's a crying shame that
Fantastic Four, Marvel in general.
Doctor Doom hasn't been in the Marvel Universe movies.
Doctor Doom is the best villain in Marvel for me.
He's awesome.
I think if you get a decent actor, you could rival Loki in the MCU.
I'd want to see him in the fucking suit and the green and stuff.
With the cape, with the armor, the whole lot.
Because he looks so badass. He's in that Punisher trade. Did you read it? He's in the Punisher trade where he turns up in Acts of Vengeance. And as soon as you see him, you're like, yes. I rate this fucking guy.
Yeah. Doctor Doom, for me, has always been up there.
Yeah, he's definitely up there.
So, yeah, look, I'm hoping it happens. I doubt we're going to see anything.
Oh, sure, it's all years away.
If they do, maybe they're selling off Fantastic Four because that's not working for them.
I don't see them selling X-Men.
And they are losing money. X-Men's they will never sell X-Men unless they sell the entire studios.
Yeah.
Like if Marvel goes and spends $30 billion and buys the whole thing, then they'll get X-Men.
Like if you're trying to acquire assets in a fire sale, Fantastic Four is something that probably would be down there, but X-Men is kind of like a crown jewel. It's making the money.
Yeah, X-Men is you buy the bank. You don't just buy that little bit.
Wouldn't it be good to be working on these corporate deals, Stu? It's almost enough. Can you just?
I feel like you and I would just send them bankrupt, acquiring all the Marvel franchise rights. Like
Dave's like jewels all around.
Yeah,
we're bankrupt, Dave. And you're like, but we own the properties.
Yeah, exactly right. But we can make a really good movie.
You own the whole world. I'd have a little monocle, Stu.
Sure, we're $40 billion in debt, but we can make a really good movie.
My day would be summoning directors and giving them my crazy pitches and then acquiring stuff. I go, here's something to run with. No, we got some ideas. And I go, I'm not that interested in your ideas. I just gave you something, don't worry. My time is precious.
What I want is a table with a lot of chairs.
Did I tell you about Wonder Woman in the robe again? They're like, their eyes glazing over. Yeah. Now, Stu, Gambit is moving forward. Lizzie Kaplan is in talks to play a female lead in the movie. Obviously, there was some speculation it would be Rogue or Belladonna, who is Gambit's love interest when he's younger.
I like both of those. I think Lizzie Kaplan's a really good actress.
Yeah, apparently she was in talks. She certainly has a lot of presence. Look, I'd be interested. And so apparently Gambit is now moving forward again, which is good. Like, I mean, come on. Like, let's get the fucking movie going. And there was some talk, Stu, that potentially there could be a Gambit teaser scene or appearance in Deadpool 2. Ryan Reynolds might, you know, pay it forward.
I mean, it's the perfect place to do it. You can get away with anything.
All the eyeballs are on Deadpool 2 when it comes out, you know?
Ooh, yeah.
Seems good to me, but I mean, let's not forget we do want the Hugh scene as well. There's a lot of scenes we want, Ryan.
We want a lot of Hugh. Yeah. So much Hugh.
By the way, Stu, I'm still in talks to have him on the show, so I'll keep
still
you
in talks. Still in talks. That's a very official way of saying you've done nothing but watch cricket.
I'm close to working out who I have to work out.
Who I have to tweet at, yeah. The bare minimum amount of effort while watching the Ashes. Love it.
It's been very
good. Look, going back to Lizzie Kaplan, I think she'd make a really good Rogue.
Yeah.
I think she would make a really good Rogue.
I'm not really familiar with her acting, but I looked at her pictures and stuff. She looks, I mean, it looks like a good look. Bit offbeat. It seems like a good visual to me. I looked at the show she's been in, nothing I've ever seen in my life. So
really, you never seen like Mean Girls?
Oh, the movie, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, of course I've seen Mean Girls.
She was in The Interview with Seth Rogen and James Franco.
Didn't see it.
127 Hours.
Didn't see it. Oh, the one where he's trapped in the cliff.
Yeah.
Didn't see it, but yeah, I know it.
Cloverfield.
Yes, seen it. Big time seen it.
Yeah,
it.
She's in Cloverfield.
Okay, Stu, but I have no idea who she is in fucking Cloverfield. There's a lot of young people in Cloverfield running around in the disaster. I often, funnily enough, I always nominate 127 Hours for James Franco as a great movie. Never actually watched a second of it.
Did you see the sequel to Now You See Me? Now You See Me 2.
No. No, I think it's the first one I've seen.
Okay, because she comes in and replaces the female lead.
Okay.
So she's a major player in that.
I know she's good, Stu. Her reputation precedes her. I'm happy to have her in the fucking movie. So bring it on, Lizzie Kaplan. Come on down, Lizzie Kaplan. Stu, how about this? Sony has landed the new Tarantino movie. Apparently a $93 million budget. Seems very specific, $93 million. Tarantino, as you would expect, has immense creative control on Final Cut.
As he should.
Yeah, I mean, come on. Who wouldn't give it to Tarantino?
At this point, it's hit after hit with him.
Exactly. Stretching back for like 20 years.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't think of too many directors who have kept a hot streak going for this long. Scorsese, probably. He's the only one I can think of off the top of my head, commercially and critically.
Yeah, I would agree. I can't think of another director that's kind of had this longevity with this much...
Yeah, I mean...
constant success.
Woody Allen had a great career, but he never had the commercial clout that Tarantino...
Yeah, and he has had a few movies that weren't critically well-received.
Yeah, definitely.
Where Tarantino's hasn't had a movie that...
Tarantino's been clever, too. He doesn't rush himself. He doesn't flood the market with his product. He takes his time. You know? Like, every movie is an event. That's hard to get to in this climate.
But, I mean, he's not being greedy, and I think that's the key. Like, when he makes $10, $20 million in 1 year, he's like, all right, I don't need to work for 7 years. I can make sure the next movie gets me another $20 million.
Yeah, like, I mean, if you said to me we're going to do a Tarantino movie night from every movie from, say, True Romance, which he co-wrote, to now, I'd be like, hell yeah.
That sounds like an amazing night. Like, a long night, but an amazing night.
It'd be long, but what I'm saying is he's got such a catalogue.
Yeah, he does.
Hits. And he does vary it as he goes along. Like, his stuff changes. If you had to pick one as your favourite, I'll give you mine. Mine is still by a whisker. And this is by a whisker, it's Pulp Fiction. By a whisker.
I think Pulp Fiction is definitely up there. I don't know.
See, I'd say Inglourious Basterds is my second. I love Inglourious Basterds.
I think Django Unchained is right up there for me.
It's very strong. Super strong. They're all strong, though, aren't they?
They're all good movies, though.
You said to me Jackie Brown. I love Jackie Brown. A lot of people forget about it, but I loved it when it came out.
Yeah, that and Death Proof always seem to get forgotten.
Yeah, definitely. Death Proof is kind of like the movie he did with Rodriguez, which was the more lower-budget style of stuff, but it was good. Did you like Planet Terror as well with Rodriguez?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, it's good fun. Like, they're good fun, but they were definitely going for more a schlocky feel, which is why I can understand. But, like, Kill Bill Volumes 1 and 2, great movies.
They're fun.
Yeah, they're a lot of fun.
Yeah.
No, he's a super talented director. And so it is interesting to see what he will do with this Manson movie. And ironically, Charles Manson just died. Currently burning in hell.
Yeah, he was 82 or something when he passed away. Yeah. Like, he lived a long and...
just awful life.
Awful life.
Yeah. I didn't really get in arguments, but there were people online going, like, every life's precious. And I just said to him, this was an evil bastard who lived to be evil, who reveled in it. Like, he really did. He reveled in his own celebrity of being evil. He had no redeeming qualities whatsoever.
And look, making him live to 82 in these miserable conditions, I think, is an amazing punishment.
Fucking eat it, Charles Manson, you know?
Like, they could have very easily just killed him.
I'm surprised he didn't get executed. How come he didn't get executed?
I think they thought this was a better punishment.
Okay.
Like, making him live for 60 years.
Do they have death row in California? Do they have it? Or maybe they don't have it.
When was he imprisoned? It was the 60s.
69 it happened.
So I don't know what they had in the 60s. That was before my time.
It was before my time as well, Stu. I wasn't on the scene. I've watched Aquarius, half of it. The
failed David Duchovny experiment.
I enjoyed it. It was kind of fun.
It was all right, but
it was okay.
He was on the radio this week because he's that band's amazing. Like, he's got a book coming out. He's got an album out.
I love David Duchovny.
He's got another movie and TV show coming out. He's like working.
More X-Files coming out too.
More X-Files coming out. Yeah. He was like, I enjoyed it, but it kind of sucked.
It was fun though.
It was all right. But even he's admitting that it didn't work that well. Like, critics hated it.
It wasn't like Californication, which was a huge hit for him.
Californication was amazing. Yeah, and X-Files was incredible.
Look, the best thing about it was actually David Duchovny. You know what I'm saying? You know, he was easily the best thing. The whole Charles Manson thing was kind of boring, actually. The actual, because you kind of know where it's going to go.
Yeah, and that is a problem going with real-world characters. I mean, this Manson thing, where we're talking it up as a Manson film...
Yeah.
But apparently it's only like a tiny... He's a character in this bigger film.
He fits in with the whole thing of the time of how... I mean, it's all coming out now, how Manson knew one of the Beach Boys, yada, yada, yada. He was kind of periphery of the sort of like folk rock scene or whatever.
Yeah.
And I do mean the very periphery, the fringes, as you would expect. I mean, this is something that doesn't... This is something I know a bit about. Like, the Summer of Love and stuff is a lie. Like, there was an epidemic heroin addiction amongst the hippies and stuff. You know what I mean? Like, this is the thing. It's all built on a fucking web of lies, man. Like George Harrison says in the Beatles Anthology, he went over to, what's it called? Haight-Ashbury Avenue, whatever it's called, in San Francisco, like the famous lane where they all lived.
Uh-huh.
And he went over there in the middle of Summer of Love. And he went over there and all he saw were these, like, stoned, desperate, thin college kids strung out on heroin and weed. And he says it was like a living nightmare.
Yeah.
Like, it's hilarious. Like, we've so rose-colored glasses the whole scene.
Oh, we have.
You know. And then you had Manson come in at the end, which is this horrible ending to the 60s myth. And, like, you had Altamont at the Rolling Stones concert where people got killed by the Hells Angels and stuff. It really is, to me, because this is my darkest, more cynical side, because I love all those songs and stuff, dude. Like, but like, the artists themselves are mythologized, dude.
Yeah.
As well. Like, I saw a really good Neil Young interview once where he was talking about Woodstock. And he was at Woodstock, and he refused to let himself be filmed because he was, like, fairly, like, very sort of anti-commercial. And he said that's where they said... They looked at all the hippies walking along the road and they went, mark it. He said, that's where corporate America went. Yeah. We can monetize this forever. And we have. We've bought and sold that myth for so long.
Yeah, we have.
And I just like to be the guy to bring everybody crashing down. I'll put in some beautiful... And I played Running on Empty last show, man. Jackson Brown. Maybe I'll do Woodstock, Joni Mitchell. I'm a complicated guy, honest, Stu. I just can't stand it when we're all supposed to believe they're all dancing in the fields. You know what I mean? Like,
I love how your mind works.
No
sometimes.
One was addicted to heroin. No one was addicted to the fucking massive amount of drugs they were taking. Like, yeah. I mean, go watch the Woodstock movie, dude, if you want to get a nice little glimpse into what the scene was like. It was fucking helter-skelter, dude. Like, seriously, there's a whole other dialogue to the whole thing, a whole other narrative than what's been pushed. Anyway, it's just one of my sort of rants.
You're still in up to 12 minutes, so...
Dustin just, like, he blew it away. Like, that was him just dust off the mic, just rolling with 12, 15 minutes solo.
Yeah.
Can you imagine me, like, kind of grinding, like, off my leash, waiting to be kind of like him?
And I can also imagine after 12 minutes, you have no idea how you got to where you are.
Oh, I totally forgot.
Just in some random side, just talking about some
and
side
project.
That's
how project the universe
of-
began, children.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's who killed JFK. Stu, how about this news item? I appreciate this film. Christopher Eccleston admits he took the role in Thor the Dark World for money.
I mean, let's be honest. I think all actors are doing it for money.
I mean, he's not the first guy, but, like, Eccleston needs to check himself before he wrecks himself, Stu. Like, all he ever does is sniff at the genre culture where he made his bones. Like, he's famous for fucking being Doctor Who for one season. He whines about it more than he was Doctor Who. Yeah. Like, it just kills me.
Yeah, he's got such a fan base that did follow him through Thor, through Doctor Who.
Yeah. What else has he fucking been in? I don't even know.
He was in 28 Days Later.
Okay.
He was kind of the villain in 28 Days Later.
Okay, cool. Well, that's cool, but it was also 10 years ago.
Yeah, it was also 10 years ago. But he's got a bit of a cult following with his kind of nerd genre culture.
But he seems to hate it. Like, he hates Doctor Who, won't talk about it.
Yeah, because he wants to be taken as a very serious actor, and he's not willing to go with that fandom and kind of roll with it.
But does he not realise, if he's taking the money for a role, which I understand he's an actor, okay, and it's not his fault that Thor the Dark World wasn't the greatest movie and didn't have the greatest film. That's true. A lot of that comes down to the script, really does.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually okay. But the thing is, he was good as Doctor Who. He could make so much more money and get so much more momentum by embracing that culture.
Yeah, like, getting really, his name out there, yeah.
Like David Tennant, Matt Smith, they've all done the same thing. And they don't sit there whinging. The second you whinge about being Doctor Who to Doctor Who fans, they start really getting the shits.
Yeah, because those fans are so passionate and so caring when you let them.
And I like Christopher Eccleston. Like, I still like him. I thought he had a cool interpretation of the Doctor. He had a challenging first season, script-wise. But it had a lot of, you know, ups and downs in that season. But he was fine. And I was disappointed when he regenerated. But then when I found out he was, like, sort of, like, didn't want to talk about it, hates to talk about it, never will answer a question, it's kind of like, really, dude? Like, you could have come back and done more on the TV with it.
Yeah, I mean, you look at what David Tennant's done, where he went the opposite direction.
Yeah.
He leant into it. He went full on Doctor Who.
Yeah.
He then did cameos in Harry Potter. He went on to do a villain in Jessica Jones.
Exactly.
And he, like, he attends Comic-Con, loves it.
He's doing something now, isn't he? Isn't he in some new show as well? Like, I mean, yeah, David Tennant's had a very good career out of the whole thing.
Yeah, Matt Smith makes videos of him walking the floors at Comic-Con.
Yeah, like, he's loved.
Exactly, they both love it.
I never understand that when you sniff at your own work and you're really just revealing something about yourself which people don't want to know.
I mean, look, I think if he came out and said it wasn't the best season, but I still enjoyed playing the character,
that's fine.
He can get away with that all day long.
Because you know what?
Plenty of actors have come along and said, I didn't like that role.
Imagine if Tom Baker, okay, talking about classic doctors, said, oh, I can't stand being the Doctor. I hate the Doctor.
You couldn't. You couldn't do it.
I mean, he's so iconic. I've got a picture of him up there. Like, it doesn't even fathom into your brain. Professional actors don't do that. They just go, oh, no, it was a great experience. I had a great time. Like, it's in the past. But, yeah, if it was right again, I'd do it again, you know?
I mean, there have been quite a few actors that have said that role wasn't good.
Mm.
But, I enjoyed the experience, but that movie wasn't good. It wasn't well received.
Sure. But I'm not a fan of the way Chris Eccleston says this kind of stuff. But he clearly feels that way about it, doesn't he? He just, and he never really seems to have, like, the giant hit that you would think. Like, where's the fucking Oscar? Like, seriously. Where's the fucking Rain Man? Where's the film that defines him as the serious actor? I don't see it. I know him as the Doctor. And whatever else. You said 28 Days Later. Don't remember him, but I like the movie.
He was the villain, the army.
Okay. Well, we said, it was years ago. There was a villain.
It was a while ago, yeah.
It was a long time ago. I don't know, man. He needs to maybe take a good hard look in the mirror. It would be hilarious if, like, he came and did Doctor, does it, and everyone's like, oh, he's really good again. Then he goes to Graham Norton and goes, I did it for the money. And it's like, oh, this is just sad now.
Well, I mean, notice that he wasn't invited back when they did the 50-year anniversary
special. He was invited, though. He didn't want to go. It's true. He's
like when they had Tennant and Matt Smith there.
He's rebuffed.
And Baker was invited and he was there.
Yeah. He's rebuffed multiple invitations to come back. The guy who just left, the showrunner who just left Moffat, and I believe the guy before him, have tried multiple times to get him to come back and do it.
Yeah.
So, no, he's rejected multiple. It's not a question of him being ignored by them, because I think they acknowledge that he kind of broke it back in. No, it's all his own attitude, dude. So, whatever, man. It's not the end of the world, but it's just something I find a little bit disappointing. Something I don't find disappointing, Stu. We have some more news on the DC streaming service.
Woo!
Yeah, the first news since the announcement of this great new streaming service, which had two shows. Guess what, Stu? They're up to three.
I mean, that's an impressive improvement.
Yeah, I know. Three shows, Stu. A Harley Quinn animated series is set for the DC streaming service.
I like Harley Quinn. I like animated. I mean,
so do I. I'm down.
This is a 50% bump in numbers as well. It's huge.
Yeah, and it's just amazing thinking about three whole shows, Stu, on this channel.
I mean, that'd last us at least, a weekend?
Weekend. Ooh. I'm just going to rotate it constantly. It's the most ill-planned announcement. Like, they announced this thing months ago.
They announced they're going to do a streaming service. So this is going to be like the Netflix of DC. You log in, you pay your $12 a month or whatever it is. You log in for the first time, and you've got an option of three shows.
Yeah, it's just... And there were people like Jordan Edwards, shout out to Jordan. I was going back and forth with him on Serious Issues fan page. Look, basically, dude, like, he was saying they've got my money. And I said, not me, big guy. Like, they need to give me details. I want... Stu, when you announce you're going to roll something out, okay... As a consumer, you want to know what you're going to be signing up for. I want to know how much. I want to know, is it going to include comics? What shows are you going to have? Give me the whole fucking, like, ball and wax of what's going
to
be.
Well, see, I don't know. I don't think they need to do that. I mean, look at what Disney have done. They've said, we're going to have a streaming service, and it's going to be competitively priced with Netflix.
Yes, but they also have a huge backlog of movies.
I think, exactly. I think at that point, you're like, well, yeah, that's cool, sign me up. That's Disney has years worth of products.
That's Disney.
Disney is going to be cheaper than Netflix and Jordan years of product. Oh, go for it.
On all the old CW shows. Will they? Because they have distribution deals with all these different networks.
Uh-huh.
And with Netflix and everyone else, where's all that? I don't think they have any idea. And this
is a nightmare to pull these shows. Same as Marvel with Disney. They're not going to be pulling the shows from Netflix for a while.
It would make more sense to say there's a Warner streaming service. Like
Warner's I would sign up for. Warner's is a massive studio.
Yeah. But just DC, it just...
DC streaming services, yeah.
Well, like, you've got Batman and... Like, just let's assume, as Jordan was saying, let's assume they get all the previous animated series.
Let's look at every single TV show DC has ever released.
Okay, there all the can't Batman be, animated series, all the Batman shows, say...
There can't be more than, what, 24 TV shows?
Probably about that, Stu, including all the animated stuff.
I mean, that's not enough for a streaming... Like, can you imagine signing into Netflix and having 12 options, 12 shows?
I know, I'm going, ooh, woohoo, look at me.
Yeah.
I don't get it either, dude. And
like, you've got my money for this month, but then next month you got nothing.
And they've been so just, like, barren on details. Like, so far they've announced 3 shows, Stu. Young Justice Season 3, so you're coming into something in Season 3, and we're all supposed to be, like, so excited. I'm very fucking...
I mean, even if they threw in the DC movies at this point, it's underwhelming.
It's underwhelming, Stu. And people are going, oh, I think it'll include the comics. Well, we haven't heard that, have we? So I don't tend to believe it stuff from major corporations.
It would have to include the comics for me to be interested at this point.
Yeah, me either. I have to have naked women dancing around for me to be interested at this point, because I'm not interested by 3 fucking shows.
I feel like that would make anything interesting for you, Dave.
It would, Stu, but enough for me to part with my cash, I don't know. As I said to Jordan, they're going to have to work a lot hard for the Davey dollar. Because the Davey dollar is not being...
Everybody has to work very hard for the Davey dollar.
Very true.
Very hard. True, Stuart. Oh, by the way, when we get to... Our little Punisher thing. Remind me to talk to you about Davey Dollars.
Okay.
Because there's something coming up that I think you'll enjoy.
Okay, good. Yep. All right. Stu, this is kind of funny. Joe Quesada, Joe Q, mentioned that he liked DC better when Marvel hired him in the late 90s. He famously turned around Marvel with the Marvel Knights, with Jimmy Palmiotti and stuff. He explained he was a Marvel fan as a kid and a DC fan as an adult. I was all about the DC when Marvel hired my company to do Marvel. It felt weird, kind of dirty. DC was just putting out better books at that time. Then it went on to kick their asses. I kind of like his attitude there.
Yeah, so do I.
He's kind of got
like... I like that, actually. I like that he was admitting that when he came into it, it was a bit of a mess and the other company was doing it better.
They were close to bankruptcy.
He turned it around.
Yeah, exactly. And all the properties had been sold. He turned it around with the Marvel Knights, Line the Punisher stuff, all sorts of stuff he did. Yeah, and he's still there, dude. He's their chief creative officer or whatever he is now.
He is, yeah.
Did you see Axel Alonso actually left as well?
Yeah. There's been a bit of movement in the comic industry.
I probably should have put that in the news. I was probably watching a bit too much cricket.
I mean, editor-in-chief leaves Marvel is kind of a big bit of news, but...
I meant to put it in the news. I thought about it several times. I need to do that, and then just like...
And then the next ball was bowled. Yeah, you're like, let's just focus on this.
I just can't be bothered.
Priorities, Dave. Cricket. Priorities. You've got to write.
But I've remembered it. Now, and CB, I believe his name is Sabowski or something, who was their scout talent agent internationally, who's been there at ages, is now the new editor-in-chief incoming. So he's like a long-standing,
he's been there for decades.
Decades. Was a writer, had all sorts, did a lot of talent searching around the globe.
But he was never a big name as a writer.
No. But as a talent guy, he's been around for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. So, he's been in and around Marvel for a very long time.
Yeah, exactly. So that's interesting. Stu, we're time for Punisher Playbook.
You and me, we want the same thing. So work with me.
One condition. I'm gonna kill them all.
Yeah, I can live with that.
And
I'm actually excited for Punisher Playbook.
Punisher. I'm always excited.
This is a good Punisher Playbook.
This is a good one.
This is not you just forcing Punisher into a show that doesn't need Punisher.
Don't worry.
There's legitimate Punisher news.
Next week we'll do that, kids. But Punisher Playbook, this show is going to focus on, obviously, the Punisher Netflix show. 13 episodes. Stu, you made it through?
I found the time to watch 13 hours worth of Netflix.
Stu, unlike me, has been very busy this week.
I'm just putting it out there. There are going to be some pretty serious spoilers ahead. If you haven't seen the Netflix show, go out and binge watch it and come back.
And I'm not going to bother editing this and doing all sorts of bullshit. Like, seriously, just... Yeah, if you haven't seen Punisher Netflix yet...
Click pause.
Go watch 13
episodes. Go binge watch it for 13 hours. You've got a weekend.
Then come back.
Come back, click play again.
Imagine me grumpy as waiting as you do that as well, as Punisher would. Standing by with a gun to your head, maybe. Just get through it, kids.
That got dark quickly.
Yeah. I just get so annoyed by the whole spoiler culture. They're babies today, Stu. Like, they're children. They're little infants.
Let's let them enjoy Punisher, though. Okay, I think you're on common ground with them for this. If I came up to you day one and said, by the way, this is what happens in Punisher.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
You would have been pretty pissed.
I agree with that, but it's just, fair notice. That's
and look, at the rate we've been going, I have been watching one or two episodes a night.
Sure.
And I've just managed to get through it. I finished it last night. I think you did as well.
Yeah. Michelle and I, we finished it last night.
So it took us a week to get through it.
Yeah.
And we started day one as well.
One night we did about four or five. Michelle kept going another one. And I had to do my review for Batman Universe, but I think we got through five one night. Four or five.
Yeah. You so I was like consistently one or two a night.
Yeah.
So I'm at a reasonable pace, it takes a week to get through. Okay. So
let's break it down from the top. Okay. I'm gonna say something that probably won't surprise you, Stu. I had the most fun out of any of the Netflix shows. And I also found such a fluid show. I really didn't find this a chore to watch at all.
No, it certainly wasn't a chore to watch. Mm. I feel like, for me, it felt a little behind Daredevil.
Sure. Which season of Daredevil?
Two.
Daredevil season two is very strong.
And I felt, for me, it actually felt very similar to Jessica Jones for a large portion of this.
Jessica Jones is one of my favorite of the entire...
I was getting a lot of similarities between this and Jessica Jones. Yeah.
Well, a dark, conflicted
lead. And I was enjoying it.
Dark, conflicted lead.
For me, John Bernthal was a pretty fantastic Punisher.
Fantastic.
There were moments that I didn't like what he was doing with the character. I felt it seemed out of place.
He had a lot of emotion. I love John Bernthal.
Actually, the level of emotion I didn't expect.
Yeah, I love John Bernthal as an actor from Shane and Walking Dead. I love Shane and Walking Dead. And I loved him in Wolf of Wall Street. I'm a big believer in him as an actor. I thought he lit the screen up as Frank Castle. He gave me Frank Castle with more heart, more rawness than I imagined, but I dug it. I mean, this was a guy who just seemed to be on a powder keg of emotion.
Yeah, and I really didn't mind the fact that he was driven by this emotion. I think that fits in with the character better than anything else. Yeah. It was those moments where he almost seemed psychotic.
Oh, yeah.
Where he would sit there, and especially talking to Micro.
Man. He couldn't talk with Micro sometimes. He got so mad.
Yeah, and he was just kind of staring into nothingness, like swaying back and forth, almost as if it was borderline like autism or something medical. Well,
let's break it down. At the beginning of the show, let's not forget, he's got the beard. He is out of it.
Yeah, hipster. I love that they kept calling him hipster.
He progresses a long way in 13 episodes. You forget because it's such a good flow. But at the start of the show, when I paused to reflect, I mean, he was out of it. He completed what he felt was his mission by annihilating the last guy with the sniper shot.
Yeah, and so then he just killed all the guys.
The reason to live.
He linked all those guys with the death of his family.
Yeah.
And he thought that was done. And he just spent his days using a hammer to smash through walls at a construction site.
Exactly. He was a pretty loose cannon, to be honest. And he didn't want to have anything to do with anyone. I mean, he was as isolated as it gets.
Yeah.
That guy tried to be friends with him, and he was just... Everything would flash him back to the constant recurring pattern of Maria getting shot in the head. He was just... The recurring dream he had, he was gone. But then one of the things, I want to put this up front of the show. I was chatting to Mike Barron, by the way, who created Micro. And I think they really got that Micro-Frank relationship, which is in all the comics for all the 90s and 80s. They got the heart of it. And I said to you, Stu, before this show, that Micro wasn't the fat guy in the Hawaiian t-shirt, which he is in... all the Punisher comics.
Yeah, they modernized large aspects of the story. They kept the characters true.
Yeah.
They kept the key moments of backstories true.
Exactly.
But they modernized these characters to fit in.
And to be honest, let's face it, they didn't have to change too much. Micro was a computer hacker back then.
Yeah.
They updated it to now, but they
where got he's a CIA analyst.
Exactly. They got the relationship between the two of them so on. Like, Micro is actually there to help Frank heal, to guide him and point him in the right direction.
But they were both kind of forced together.
Oh, yeah.
And they both, they're not friends.
No.
They work together and they found
this. They're as close as a friend that Frank gets. They're as close as it gets for Frank.
Well, no. I mean, we've seen in this that he had...
He had
a couple of proper friends.
Yeah, that's true.
Even Billy Russo at the beginning of this, they were good friends.
Good point. Well, he's a partner, let's put it that way. But to be honest, though, Micro is so necessary to Frank if you're really into Punisher, right? And I thought the show understood that. And also, though, Frank, as you are right in saying, Stu, he did have emotional capacity. He wasn't a completely charred, burnout, ruin. He goes beyond damaged. This is a guy who's almost been destroyed by the level of guilt and anger that he has for what happened to his family. What I love with Berthold's performance, at times he would talk to you like I'm talking to you now when he's talking to Micro. He'd be really potentially on the level. Then Micro would say something which would just trigger him. And he could barely speak. He was so full of rage.
Yeah.
Not at Micro, at the situation and at the people he had to kill. And it just kept coming back to that point. He goes, I am going to have to kill them all. And Micro's like, okay, I'm done with that. Like, Micro wasn't the kind
of... There were moments where Micro was like, no, you can't kill them all. And then eventually he just kind of came around to this, just let Frank be Frank.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like Frank is going to do what he wants to do.
Yeah.
One thing I love, Stu, and this is from back in the day, the battle van, man. Every time they hopped in that black van, I was a man in heaven. There was so many nods, Stu, to little bits and pieces that make the Punisher the Punisher. This show is, you can tell, is one for the fans. It really felt like this is Marvel's Netflix's love letter to the Punisher fans who've waited so long to get it. I didn't really care about small little differences. I mean, I'm as haunted by Maria's death in this show as I am in the comics. It felt real. Frank's relationship with Billy Russo, that came out of left field. It delved into his past in the war. I thought that was brilliant. The stuff with the CIA head, the guy he went after, that creep. That was a great storyline.
Yeah, there were quite a few villains there that really worked in the CIA, especially.
How about the shot he took? And it was...
It was the bulletproof glass.
Yeah, that was a great shot.
Yeah, and you see that cracked just perfectly on his forehead.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that was really cool.
I can break it down more critically than this, but I had a great time, Stu. I mean, it's a 9 out of 10. I felt the, out of all the subplots, I loved the feeling at the start, and it also is where it winds up, at the support group for the vets, okay?
I was wondering what you felt of that last line. Like, the very last line in the movie was Frank saying that he was scared.
No, I liked it because I think that
does that fit in with you? The idea that he's going to these group therapy sessions now, he's aware that the war is over, and he's actually scared of what's to come.
Yeah, I mean, the war's never over for Frank. There's always another incident that will kick it off. But you've got to look at it from the angle of where they're going. In the comics, Stu, the classic comics that I like from originally, he is so burnt out, and it's so ingrained in his DNA, that's what happened to Maria and the kids, that there never is an end point. But, let me put a but here, in this kind
of... But, I mean, he has actually said that the war that I've fought, all the wars that I've fought are now over.
Yeah, but do I believe that, Stu? No. I think that there's quite a good chance we'll get Punisher Season 2.
We're going to get another season, and he's going to be in another Netflix show.
So, no, I had no problems with having an emotional moment for Frank there, because I think this was more of an emotional Frank than you get in a lot of the comics that I love. I like this angle. I like the way Berthold played it. I think you needed to pay it up. I mean, dude, he took such a beating in the climax. He took
a
hard beating. And let's not forget about the beating he took by Russo and by the CIA guy.
Rawlins. Yeah.
And then, obviously, he punished him and then gave the absolute bloodiest...
Last two episodes were hyper-violent.
Yeah, which it needed.
They held nothing back.
I mean, Frank is drenched in blood. Figuratively, literally, everything.
I mean, how he survived any of this is beyond me.
Yeah, he's got... I agree. And that's the comics, too. He's taken so many shots to every part of his body in every single Punisher comic ever.
And when they get him back to the house, like when they get him back to Madani's flat, it's like, yeah, he's got one broken rib.
Yeah, I know.
I'm like, really? Really? He's been tortured for 2 days by a CIA operative.
Yeah, I know.
He's bleeding out of every orifice.
And he was literally blanking out, flashing to Maria. Funnily enough,
I enjoyed those. I enjoyed whenever he passed out, he would go to his happy place kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he was dancing with Maria and...
Guess what, Stu? Late in the Punisher trade, the car pots when we're doing this week, I got to a scene where he flushes to Maria when he's just taking a beating from someone.
Yeah.
How it's... There were so many little nods in this series. I loved it. And so, no, I as a John Bernthal fan, I feel that he's done such service to this character that they earned that moment from me. And I'm not the guy who wants Punisher to forever be weeping in a corner, but I like that he took such amount of punishment, as did his friends, and the betrayal of Russo.
I really like the idea towards the end where killing him was what he wanted. It was a mercy for him.
Yeah, he begged
every time they blacked him out, he was going to Maria.
Oh, yeah, sorry, Frank. Yeah.
So every time he would get knocked out, he was going and he was dancing with Maria and he was having this...
Yeah.
You know, reunion.
But then
and then he'd get brought back into reality.
Yeah.
And he'd kind of have to struggle back through life.
They gave him that adrenaline shot. That was a bad move by Rawlins. when he did that, I was like, that may backfire on you, I thought to myself.
Well, to be fair, he had just been released by Billy.
I know. So. I know. That Rawlins guy, I mean, he's the guy you just want to hate. Don't you hate that guy so much in this show?
Yeah, and I was expecting him to turn out to be the big bad. And it was a nice surprise to me when Billy Russo was the bad.
Well, yeah, was that a surprise to you? Did you know that Billy Russo was going to be the bad guy?
I didn't. No. At the end when he was, like, destroying his face, I went, hang on, I know there is a villain. Like, I'm not a huge Punisher guy.
No, yeah.
But I knew there was a recurring villain Jigsaw. In Punisher, Jigsaw, that had that bloodied up face.
So even when he was revealed to the viewer to be the bad guy when he killed...
I just assumed he was a bad guy.
How good was the episode where... Because I really liked the... What's her name? Madani?
Madani, yeah.
Loved her. Loved her performance.
She was fantastic.
Really enjoyed that subplot, Stu.
Yeah.
Really got involved in that subplot. I don't know if there's been a... Like, there's definitely been Punisher cops who've, you know, chase a Punisher before. There's even been female Punishers before. We had, you know, various people like Rachel... I think Alves her name is, I think, in the Rucker comics.
Yep.
All sorts of things.
Yeah.
But... Her subplot, Stu, was so engaging, so well acted by that actress.
There was a brilliant scene just after Billy Russo had killed her partner.
Oh, yeah. That was horrific.
And then he takes her home and he's, like, bathing her, like, trying to comfort her.
That was
and
so
you could see that she's absolutely destroyed.
She's traumatized. She's in trauma.
Absolutely traumatized. Her partner just died in front of her in her arms.
Gurgled death out in her arms.
Yeah, and he's sitting there stroking her, and you could see the look on his face like
creep.
He's literally just killed this guy, run around the block to change his clothes, and come back.
Yeah, he's a loose cannon himself. He was a pretty loose unit mentally.
He was actually an amazing villain.
No, he was good.
I think in the Marvel Netflix universe...
Is he famous at all? Because I thought he acted very well as well.
He's not a massive known... Not a massively
owned... She was great.
Amber Rose Reaver was Madani.
Yeah, is she done?
No, none of them are hugely known actors.
She was fantastic, Stu. I've got to say, like, I really got into her story, and I could see her in many of the cop shows that Michelle watches. She would fit in like, you know, like clockwork.
Yeah.
She was great, Stu. I really enjoyed her performance. I actually felt that this was a really strong show overall. I mean, Michelle, she's not a Punisher. She kept saying to me, you know, Punisher's not real, Dave, because I was just getting so into it. But she really enjoyed it a lot. I think this is
a really engaging show.
It's emotionally quite a draining show. It's also a real insight. I kept saying to Michelle, this is why I like Punisher. Like, this got me, this is like, see how angry he is. See what's been taken from him. This is what drives him. It's the fuel. I was like, finally we're getting beyond just the caricature. We're getting into the character, the absolute heart of the Punisher character. I thought this was fantastic. Now, Stu, do you have any sort of counterpoints or bits that you really want to signal out?
I mean, there is one massive point that I think needs to be said, and it involves Davey Dollars.
What are you talking? Yeah, well, I don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's one of our little signal bets that we had.
Did I win?
Where you said that he would definitely sleep with Karen Page.
Well, he went fucking close. Jesus Christ.
Didn't even kiss. Nowhere near.
Stu, you are downplaying. Firstly, she kissed him on the cheek. There was so much sexual tension between the two of them. It was crackling.
How much happened? You know that. How much happened? Anything?
Let me tell you why.
Did they definitely have sex?
Let me quote.
Was there a hot and heavy relationship on screen?
Let me quote something from you, Stu.
Uh-huh.
This is Chuck Dixon. Quote from Chuck Dixon to me, to David Finn, on the Signal. He said, every woman reminds him of his dead wife. The only reason that they didn't kiss in that elevator scene is because she is so much of a soulmate to Frank Castle in this
show. I love that you know all of this. You've spoken to the creators. You know this character inside and out. And yet you're still willing to make bets saying that he's going to sleep with Karen Page.
Listen to this, Jim.
And it's worth $5. You're going to come to me and collect that $5 so happily when he sleeps with Karen Page.
Well, if he had, I wouldn't have been too concerned.
No, you would have been $5 up as well.
Yeah, $5 up.
Right now, you're $5 down and trying to get on some moral high ground by quoting the creator.
I'm going to take you on the moral high ground because...
Dave, you made this bet. You're the only person that said they were going to sleep together.
Listen to this.
You're the only one.
Listen, no, plenty of people on the internet speculated that this would happen.
They were never going to sleep together. It was never going to happen.
But would you agree with me, though? I felt the connection between them in that scene... I really enjoyed that episode where it's the assassination attempt... And all that shit's happening in all different people's points of view.
Yeah.
I always love a different points of view episode. And I was digging it. But when they were in that scene and there is so... Did you not sense there was such a connection between... It's only because she gets how much he loved Maria. That's actually it, Stu. She actually fully saw into his soul.
He had more tension with Micro's wife.
She had a fair bit of tension with Micro's wife.
Yeah.
I actually thought Frank at one point was going to...
So did I. And I was like, if he does this, does this void our bet? Like,
I was like, okay, Frank, you're really playing to this role a bit.
Yeah.
And
he... Do you realize...
What's happening with Frank?
I like that he plugged in the cameras before he did that as well.
Yeah.
Just to rub it in.
Look, Micro's wife was a beautiful actress herself, actually, I felt.
Yeah.
But did you notice that when Micro came back, she didn't stop saying, where's Frank? What happened to Frank? She was like, really wanted some updates on the Frank
house. These are the kids. The kids were all like, where's Frank?
Yeah.
Is Frank coming?
Yeah, look, I mean, obviously they didn't have sex to you. I thought they were going to for a second, and I did remember our bet during that moment, and I thought, I was laughing, I was chuckling to myself, because I didn't remember if I'd said kiss. I didn't remember, did I say full sex?
To be honest, it doesn't matter, because they didn't do anything. They didn't even kiss.
If only could bother to review the tapes.
Like, they had nothing.
She kissed him on the cheek.
I'm pretty sure that's just a...
She kissed him on the cheek.
It doesn't count. It doesn't count towards anything.
And he kissed her on the cheek, too.
That doesn't count. How does that count?
Okay, it doesn't count.
There we go. Problem. That's what I want to hear, Dave. That's what I want to hear.
Like, Stu...
I want to hear you admitting defeat. That's what I want.
I mean...
It happens so rarely on a Punisher topic.
I mean, like, I'm sneering at even the thought of admitting anything. I'll happily pay you $5
right there. We go.
Defeat. Like, it's a technical draw as far as I'm concerned.
It's a TKO.
I mean, Stu, the only reason that didn't happen... I mean, and
the only reason,
it should have happened. I mean, she was. Would you say this? Was she up for it? Yes, is my question. I think she is fully enamored with Frank Castle, but she understands the level of damage he's taken.
No, I disagree.
What?
I think she respects Frank, but she's not enamored.
Okay, you don't think there's like a sexual tension there at all? Because I think there is.
I mean, there is a little bit, but there was more between her and Daredevil than there was between her and Frank.
Fuck Daredevil! Like, he's a red clown. I think it was fully on the table and it was a serious possibility, but we're also under serious attack at the time.
No, it was never going to happen.
I'm happy. You know what?
Just witnessed the death of a bunch of people in an explosion. Like, she's not. That's not exactly going to get her in the mood.
I thought a kiss was going to happen, big time. Not a fuck. Not in an elevator where.
I mean, $5 said it was fuck. But
I've just got a feeling that like it was a kiss. But I thought in the context of the situation. That a kiss was fully on the table. Fully on the table. I expected it to happen. I thought it was going to happen. I was kind of disappointed, although I respected for the sense of characters that she had the full insight into Frank's soul. It was like she was inside his head, and she knows that that's the hall of mirrors that all lead to Maria. Like, that's the only woman he really truly loves. So, I mean, yeah, it's true. If it matters that much to you, dude, I'll obviously pay you $5, but I'll admit some defeat, but with a sneer, because I feel like this was probably just... They'll worry about Punisher fan reaction.
Dave, the $5 is worth so much more with the sneer. That's why I wanted it.
Yeah.
It's not even about the $5. It's the sneer that I wanted, let's be honest.
Well, sure. If I was on the script, they would have... if I was on the script, he may have actually nailed Micro's wife.
If you were on the script, there barely would have been a plot. It just would have been women and Frank.
Frank killing and crack...
And then... When he's tired of the women, he'd just go out and kill some people.
Oh, no, Frank's
Then come back Frank's to the women.
Look, from my knowledge of Punisher, Frank's never been a player, because it is true, every woman reminds him of his wife. Like, he's more about protecting them than saving them. But he's fucked Elektra, he's fucked the chick in Punisher Warzone that Chuck did. Like, he's had sexual liaisons. Frank, but none of it's love, Stu, you know what I mean? In the comics, there is no love. This guy had more. John Berthenol's guy had a bit more genuine emotion still left. I felt it's a complicated situation, but at the end of the day, he did not kiss her. I have to admit, there was that kiss on the cheek, and I mean, she's an attractive lady, and I kept thinking that was flashing through my mind as well. I thought, Frank, like, it's available. It's, hey, the moment's here.
Micro's wife was available. That I thought was going to happen.
Wow. I've got to be honest. If I was in Frank's shoes, I might have just said, put something over the little camera.
Let me just unplug. Let me just unplug your Wi-Fi first. No reason. Just let me unplug the Wi-Fi.
Because she was definitely up for it. And that's not a sexist comment. That was just a very, very sensual lady.
Who had just been a year without a husband.
Thought her husband was
who,
dead.
By the way, and I'm quoting, was weirdly hung.
That was funny.
That was a hilarious scene.
That was a very funny scene. I really enjoyed the chemistry between the two of them. And Michelle and I were saying, Frank, this is going to... I was even saying, Frank, you can't do it. Dude, I know that you... It would be funny. And also, like...
You know, I honestly thought he was going to, just because of the tension it would cause.
I think as well, Frank, like, this is just my interpretation... I think that family setting, you know, that's... He was so isolated when he walked into that house. And then he was sort of happy to help her. Frank, from what I've read in the comics and stuff, he quite likes domesticity and stuff like that. That's what he lost.
Well, I mean, obviously this was a wife who wasn't dissimilar to his wife.
Yeah.
There was a son and a daughter.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it was the perfect suburbia setting.
And, you know... Frank has so
and much. Yeah, exactly. And their loss was that one bit of the family unit, which was the male father.
He does
father.
Have, like, a hen mother personality towards women. He really does. He really does have a thing about trying to protect. And, I mean, he was more than happy to help around the house. Look, I'm glad he didn't do it, because I quite like Micro. And Micro in this was quite a likable guy, although he was a bit of a weirdo and a bit offbeat. He was quite a likable character.
For me, the bit I didn't like was when Micro just forgave him instantly.
Well,
he basically said, yeah, she's an attractive lady, I don't blame you.
Well, he got pissed and stuff, Stu. I mean, he got over it, dude.
He was drinking, but he never got angry. He never...
That kind of relationship, dude, where you have to roll. If you're going to be in Frank's company, you have to learn to roll with Frank.
Well, yeah, but I feel like if Micro had just, like, shot Frank in the knee or something...
Fuck that, dude.
He could have got away with it, and Punisher would have taken it because he knew he was in the wrong.
No, it was more... Dude, it was more like War Buddies. Frank didn't actually go there, if you remember. He didn't fuck her. He sort of kissed her.
They definitely kissed.
He gave a little bit back in that kiss.
Yeah, he did.
Well,
it was a solid kiss. It was way more of a moment than he had with Karen Page.
Micro, at the end of the day, look, I hate to break the news, he's a bit of Frank's bitch. And sometimes that's what
it is. See, I would have liked him to actually, like, lash out and hit Frank.
Well, he did. He tried to. He swung at him.
He was so drunk at that point.
But, like, Frank versus Micro isn't a fair fight.
Like, no, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Like, Punisher would have just taken the hit and gone, I deserve that. Let's move on.
I don't think it's worth a knee shot, Stu, but, like, in the context of what they're doing. But a punch in the
gut. Put a bullet in the shoulder. Something that's not going to slow him down.
Have you seen Last Boy Scout where I think whoever the character is, Bruce Willis and the partner, when he finds he's sleeping with his wife and he goes, where do you want a face or gut? He goes, gut. Punches him in the gut. It was worth that, I thought. Like, that's all it was. They didn't actually fuck Stu. And he did eject from the situation. He did. He did, if you recall. If you go back and review the tapes, it was awkward. But I also thought that he was driving Micro a bit crazy. I thought he was deliberately doing a little bit by really helping around the house, going the extra mile and stuff. Like, it was kind of funny.
Well, I mean, it started off with him just trying to interrogate to find out more information about Micro.
Sure.
Because that's how he found out who Micro was.
Yeah, that's right, because he didn't know originally. That was good stuff, man. I dug the whole thing. I mean, I'd give the show... I could even go higher than a 9. I really honestly loved it, Stu. I walked in with some pretty high expectations just based on what I know of John Berthenol's acting and what I felt the move was going to be right. I mean, I got it. Stu, I'm going to go 9.5. I really had a good time with this.
I had a good time as well. I'm giving it an 8.5 out of 10.
High score.
Very enjoyable. A few moments for me were a little too gory and too... Sure. The last two episodes especially are hyper-violent.
Oh, they're very violent, yeah. It's for 13 and up. It's not under 13 kids.
I would say older than that. It's
a 13-year-old could handle this, Stu.
It's full-on.
Yeah, it's still on, but it's all pretend, guys. Like, I mean, really, a 13-year-old, from what I know, a 13-year-olds could pretty much handle this.
Yeah, but when you're watching someone gouge out another person's eyes and kill them with their bare hands.
Eyeballs pop out.
No, you saw them being, like, crushed into his skull and blood pouring out.
I don't know, man.
And then Punisher creating Jigsaw's iconic face.
Dude, when I was 13 years old...
Like, hearing him, like, this blood-curdling scream as Frank dragged his face through glass...
Oh, yeah, that was good.
...and ripped off the right side of his face.
That was necessary, because that guy really was a real prick.
Yeah, but, I mean, you see everything. There's full-on gore.
Look, if you're going to be turned off by violence... Yeah, there's a lot of violence, especially...
See, for me, the first, like, 8 or 9 episodes...
Yeah.
There's violence, absolutely. Yeah. There's gunfights, there's knife fights, but it's kind of expected violence.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't go over the top. There's
quite bloodless.
Yeah, but towards the end, it's torture scenes. It's full on...
I knew we were going to get there. When Frank started to sacrifice himself for the torture, I was like, yeah, we're going to go somewhere dark now.
Yeah, and it went there. It was dark.
For sure. Well, I mean, that wraps up Punisher Playbook. We had a really good time with it. I'm sure we'll get Punisher Season 2. John Berthenol just keeps growing as an actor who seems to... He just seems to be in love with the character too. Doesn't that help, Stu? He's embraced his role of Punisher so seriously, and he knows what it means to fans, members of the military, many of whom are fans, like, and police officers and stuff. Like, he gets the importance of Punisher to a certain segment of this audience, and he serviced them so well. It's kind of hard to believe he's acting at times. Like... You feel like it really is a true guy, Frank Castle. Like, sometimes I was just like, man, this is such good stuff. Like, and just as a show, I've enjoyed all the Netflix shows, but sometimes they feel like a chore. This didn't feel like a chore. These episodes flew by. What did you think, Stu? Probably the weakest subplot out of all the subplots was the subplot of the soldier who went psycho with the bombs. That was probably the weakest subplot for me.
Yeah, Lewis Wilson, the kid that was suffering... there was PTSD and there was psychosis and all this sort of stuff going on.
He was a pretty loose cannon.
Yeah, he was.
How about his mate, that fucking fat guy? What a prick. Like, he sold him down the river, didn't he? Like, he just sold him down the river big time. Wasn't even a vet.
Yeah.
Or hadn't gone to Vietnam.
Yeah, he worked on an army base.
Yeah.
So he got the medals, he had the uniform, and he just faked all his stories.
All these stories, and this guy just bought it left, right, and centre, a guy who was real broken up after coming back from Iraq, I think, in Afghanistan.
Yeah, look, for me, not only did I not enjoy that story, but it kind of detracted from the overall show, in that it didn't make any sense to me that a soldier would go to that extreme. And he seemed to justify it in weird ways.
Sadly, though, it happens, though. Like, psychosis is what he had. I mean, he was a loose, very loose guy.
Yeah, but he kept linking it with what the Punisher was saying and what the Punisher was doing.
Yeah.
And he kept trying to justify it by saying we're the same.
But what was he doing, like, blowing up, like... It wasn't like he was taking on crime. That would have made more sense. He was just blowing up, like, government organizations and stuff or something.
Yeah.
Didn't make a lot of sense what he was doing. Like, he was... Yeah, you're a full-on criminal, dude.
Well, I mean, the goal was to hold, like, the government to ransom.
Okay.
So, like, he would influence change by saying, if you don't change, I'm going to bomb a post office or something like that.
Union bomber style sort of thing.
Yeah, and it just didn't work for me.
Yeah, he was what I call a dead-end subplot. Like, he was just a dead end. Literally, when you get wound up in a... Dude, when you got locked into a compartment where you can blow yourself up and then you just do, that's kind of where it went. Nowhere.
Yeah.
I felt sorry for his dad. Did he kill his dad or not? He didn't kill his dad, I don't think. He shot at his dad when he woke up.
He shot at his dad, but no, he didn't kill him.
Didn't kill his dad. And Frank made that point, everything your dad's going to have isn't about you being just a colossal fuck-up.
Yeah.
Psycho. Look, I enjoyed that last scene with it, but you're right. The whole thing I thought was almost, I don't want to say distasteful, but it was almost a little too predictable. Like, one of the vets is going to go psycho, and this guy's, like, real loose. I did like, though, I do want to say this, though, because I really, overall, really dug the show.
I mean, look, for me, Curtis Hoyle was the surprise hit. The friend that ran the support group.
Loved
him. Served with him.
I was going to say that, yes.
And lost his leg. That was the hit for me. I
thought he was really good, man.
He was so well done.
I'd be interested to know, someone who's got a more encyclopedic knowledge of all the Punisher, because I'm not across every single thing, but if maybe that character is from the comics. I'll bring that up in Punisher Body Count and find out if, you know, that information. They've got a spoiler thing on their comments, I think, till 1st of December.
But after that, I'll go in there and ask those kind of questions. I'm sure Ivo Santos or someone like that, Carl Blackstone, could probably help out. They do a great job over there, guys. Punisher Body Count, one of the best Punisher podcasts out there.
So, I mean, yeah, Curtis Hoyle is in the Marvel Universe. He's okay. A character that's in...
Or I could just ask Stu on Google right now.
Mainstream Google. Yeah, he's in mainstream Marvel Comics.
Cool. In what, man? I've never heard of him in my life. Is he a Punisher character, is my question.
Yeah, Punisher character.
Okay. Has it got what kind of runs? Like, is it like...
Give me a title. He was Lieutenant in Vietnam War.
I wonder if that's like in Ennis's run or... That's kind of what I'm saying.
Look, it's a tiny character.
Okay.
Like, he makes, like, a brief appearance in, like, one or two comics. Okay.
But they cleverly took it. That's what
I wanted. And they took that name and the character.
And they ran with it.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is cool, which is a great one. Because that guy did a great job, that actor. I thought he was really good. And I think that's really important. Because all joking aside, Stu, doesn't this make you think about, like, I'm
made by Mike Baron. Mike Baron was a Mike Baron
character? Cool. Yeah. Okay, well, that's great to hear. Because Mike also did Microchip. Create a microchip. So Mike Baron's fingerprints are all over the Punisher.
So Curtis Hoyle first appeared in Punisher Volume 2, Number 1, died Volume 2, Number 2.
Oh, then I do know it. Okay, I do know it. It's Mike Baron's first issue.
So it's, Mike Baron's initial run. He came out as a lieutenant.
Yeah, I know.
Episode, died in the next.
Yep. And that's the one where Frank basically says the war caught up with him and he goes... The war is over. I quit at the end of Punisher episode 2. And I asked Mike if he really thought the Punisher had quit. He's like, no, Dave. I knew there'd be another issue. that's interesting, Stu.
So I think that's what this show does well.
Mm.
It takes characters that are in the Marvel Universe, and serious fans will recognize the name. Sure.
Deep dives, sort of thing.
Really deep dives.
Kind of Easter eggs, and then they build them into a real character.
And see, for me, the Easter egg for me was Jigsaw.
Yeah, that was great.
Like, they never said the word Jigsaw, and I know of Jigsaw.
Sure.
But I'm certainly not a huge Punisher fan. Pretty
disturbed individual.
It was enough that I recognised the villain at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
And when he was, blooding up his face and everything, I could kind of sit there going...
Dragging around.
Yeah,
and the way Frank said, no, living's going to be worse.
Yeah.
How about the way John Berthold...
Because he said, you're going to end up like me, which was, I want to die every morning when I wake up.
Can you do a John Berthenol? It's kind of like, you're on Signal of Doom. It's really deep. He just, everything's a grunt. Then he gets real loud.
It's very grunty, yeah.
Yeah, so, okay, we're going to take it down the road. And you got to do this. Do that. And then he kind of blows up real big, and then he starts getting real fucking agitated. Then he brings it back down. But then when he's talking to Karen Page, he's like, he's kind of lighter. With Karen, he's kind of lighter, more playful. And with Micro's wife, also playful. Yeah, I'll be around the house. But then once he starts getting real into his anger and stuff, you really sense the anger. He's a good actor. He acts a lot with his face and his voice, Berthenol, doesn't he? Also, I kept thinking, good-looking guy. Like, he looks younger than I think of him when I see him in movies. Actually, not that old. He could really...
For me, he was actually... less built than I was expecting.
Yeah, he wasn't as jacked, but he doesn't need
like to be. Like, he seemed quite, especially in the face and around the neck, he looked quite thin at times.
Yeah, I mean, he was wearing the black and stuff you could sort of see.
You can tell he'd been to the gym. Like, his arms were big and his shoulders were big.
Yeah. But Punisher's not a man mountain. He's just a soldier.
No, but when you first saw Punisher in Daredevil, he was built.
Mm. Okay. He's trimmed down, is what you're saying. Got leaner.
He slimmed down between seasons and then kind of... It looks like he'd just done the arms because he knew they were going to be prominent.
Too. I think he's naturally a pretty good-looking guy, Berthenol. Berthenol, have you seen Baby Driver? I know he's in that.
No, he's not.
John Berthenol is definitely in Baby Driver because he made some comments about Kevin Spacey on the set creeping him out. I haven't watched Baby Driver yet, so I was wondering how big a role he's so tiny from what
John Berthenol's in Baby Driver?
He definitely
is. You sure to think about John Hamm?
Berthenol is definitely in Baby Driver. He made some comments about being on the set of Baby Driver... when they're filming it. It's probably a very small role, Stu. But he was saying he got creeped out by Kevin Spacey there. So I assume he's in Baby Driver. I've not seen it yet, so I don't know. I was going to ask
him. Oh, yeah, no, he is.
It's probably a blink and you miss a role, Stu.
Yeah, he's one of the little grifters that shows up in one of the opening scenes.
Now, I'm probably going to watch it this weekend. Are you saying good movie to watch, Baby Driver?
Yeah, recommended. Really excellent. Good.
Okay. Well, that probably wraps up Punisher Playbook, Sean, unless you've got some other stuff. I mean, we're obviously got... Don't worry, kids. We've got more Punisher to describe this episode. And I've got a whole bunch of quotes from our trade as well, but I probably just need to just chill down a second because there was one part where I said to Michelle, I said, if the hips and fucking back are operational, I'd take you to the streets right now. That's one thing I said to you during the show. At one point, I just got real fucking agitated.
Of course you did. Sound like you at all, Dave, getting too invested in a Punisher thing.
The streets of Hornsby.
Oh, dang.
Crime ridden. Now,
Stuart, surprised you haven't bought your hoodie going out there at night patrolling the streets.
Yeah, pull the hoodie right there. Yeah. I have my Punisher caps, Joe. I'll actually, for the rest of the show, put it on for you just so you can get a real good taste of it. You know, we can get to grips with Punisher. It's, I was wearing the cap at one point during the show, and Michelle just turns on to me and she goes, "You know, you're just an old man in a hat."
Oh, that is my favourite Michelle line ever.
And I'm just there, dude, thinking things. Oh, it's just getting real intense.
You're just an old man in a hat. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, true. And I was complaining about my knees.
I love that line.
Probably an episode title, Stu, perhaps.
Just an old man in a hat, yeah.
Now, actually, okay, so look, coming out of that, Stu, I've got some comic book news as well. I want to get your reaction to this, because this really fucking grinded my gears big time, okay? Now, apparently, according to Marvel, if you recall, was it Legacy that showed at the end of Legacy the reintroduction of Wolverine, if you recall, the proper Wolverine?
Yep.
So Marvel have announced they're going to string out the return of this A-list character Wolverine over the course of other titles, doing, Stu, what they build as after-movie credits in a comic book. So after, like, Thor and fucking some other comics, Stu, that have nothing to do with Wolverine.
Uh-huh.
Not even X-Men titles, dude. Is Thor an X-Men title? Oh, no, it's not. Is Spider-Man? Oh, no, it's not. So after that, after, like, Thor, you'll get this little fucking three-pager, which is apparently going to tell a full story if you collect all the different comics of the Return of Wolverine. And I'm just so pissed off that this isn't at the... This should be at the end of, like, All New Wolverine or Old Man Logan. A Wolverine title, you know, related. Like, this is, to me, high-priced Marvel titles forcing you to pay something you don't want to just so the real fans out there, Stu, can get the three pages on the great Wolverine character finally coming back. I just think it's a really opportunistic and cynical thing, and it really actually makes me think of why I dislike the pricing model at times. Now, what do you think, Stu?
I certainly dislike the pricing, but I think this is clever marketing by Marvel.
Yeah, but, like, do I want to buy Thor fucking 202 or whatever the hell it is?
No. It's not meant for the guys that are Wolverine fans. They already have your money. When they release a new Wolverine comic. You are already going to go and buy
it. I get that, Stu, but, like...
This is meant for the Thor fans. This is meant for the Spider-Man fans. The guys that don't necessarily love Wolverine.
Okay.
They read their comic. They see a bit of Wolverine and they get intrigued.
Yeah.
They then start looking into it.
They're like, oh, the real Wolverine's back. That kind of guy.
Yeah, exactly. It's the guys that aren't up with the Wolverine news. So when they read their Thors that they get regularly and they suddenly see, you know, current Wolverine, they're like, saying.
Yeah, okay.
If he's going to come back, I'll go and buy that one.
Yeah, oh, what? No, it's no longer just like, I'm doing the sexist guy. No longer just girly Wolverine or old man or whoever, like...
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, to me, it would make more sense if it was done in X-Men titles, but you're saying they're branding out just all the...
What I'm saying is, if you're reading X-Men, you're already Wolverine fan.
If you're reading the shit X-Men titles that are available right now.
If you're in the X-Universe, you're already a Wolverine fan.
Yeah, you're probably going to get Wolverine.
Like, they've already got your money. It's not meant for you.
If you're not going to buy the actual Wolverine when he comes back and you're an X-Men fan, well, you know, God rest your soul.
Exactly.
You know?
What they're trying to go for is the fans of comic books in general...
Okay.
That aren't necessarily X-Men fans.
Well, I'm going to be a grumpy old man about it and not pay them at all. Not a fucking dime.
I mean, look, let's be honest. It was never meant for you. You are already bought and sold. As soon as Wolverine comes out...
Maybe.
The money's gone. Your money's already gone.
Maybe, Stu. Maybe.
Do you want to put a little bet on it? Or?
No, I don't want to bet on it.
Yeah, there we go. That's what I thought.
I'm already down $5. I'm also curious as to why they're delaying the return of Wolverine, who seems to have come back in Legacy months ago. We did it on the show probably 5 or 6 shows ago, it feels like. I could be exaggerating, but it was about a month ago at least. Like, it's the whole drip release of everything that annoys me. I'm not patient. I've never been a patient guy. And
I think you're in the wrong industry for a non-patient guy.
Really?
Things take weeks and months to happen in the comic book world. Like, let's be honest. You don't get...
Well, we could get an issue of Wolverine. What's so hard about doing an issue of Wolverine?
We could. I think they've got to line up a lot of things first. They've got to get the characters where they want them to be, to tell the right story. They've got to market it properly. They've got to line everything up.
Cry me a river. I mean, come back, Wolverine. Save the X-Men franchise because it's in a parlous state at the moment. Perilous. I'm not happy, Stu. I'm going to move away from this though because you made a good point, unfortunately.
Sorry about that, though.
Yeah. Did you like how my news item ended with fuck off, Marvel?
Yeah, I did like that.
In caps.
In capital letters. That's what Dave's written in the show notes here.
Once I got to the news, I was more disgusted than angry. But
I feel like this was written just after watching a bit of Punisher.
Yeah, I was pretty charged.
Where Dave's blood is up and he's you know, his heart's pounding. He's getting excited.
I'm just looking for a fight.
Yeah, exactly.
Looking for a war.
I imagine the internet copped a few this week.
That'd be pretty passive, really. Stu, what about this? Pixar released an Incredibles 2 teaser trailer. I didn't get around to seeing it due to my busy schedule. Did you watch it, Stu?
I did watch it. It's good fun. Yep. So we see Jack-Jack, the baby.
Yes.
Phase through a wall into this red room with just the Incredibles logo.
Okay.
He then uses laser vision to cut the Incredibles logo in half, revealing the new logo, which is the same logo, but now instead of an eye in the middle, it's two eyes, so it's the second one.
Cool.
So it's going to be a bit of fun. We also see Jack-Jack getting picked up by Mr. Incredible.
Cool.
And suddenly he sneezes and goes from on fire to made of lightning to laser eyes, showing that Jack-Jack is just going to have every power under the sun.
He's pretty powerful there.
Yeah, it feels very much like a Franklin Richards scenario.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, they always say that was the best Fantastic Four movie.
It is the best Fantastic Four movie. Yeah. It's honestly a fantastic superhero movie. It's one of the best superhero movies.
Oh, The Incredibles movies. Is a great film. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I mean, it feels like decades since it came out.
It's 10 years ago.
Yeah, I feel like it's even more. Like, God. Yeah, no, I'm...
They've already said Sam Jackson's back, so Frozone's going to be in it.
Oh, good.
Where's
good.
My super suit? He's back.
Excellent.
They've replaced the actor that did the boy.
Right.
Only because he's grown up, he's now a teenager, his voice is too deep.
Sure.
Because this movie is set very shortly after the first movie.
Okay.
Jack-Jack is still a baby.
Oh, okay. Right, I see. So it's not
like 10 years in, not like has 10 passed. Years have passed.
Because I was going to say, look, wouldn't that make sense? Okay, that makes a lot of sense, actually.
So this is set, I don't know, maybe months or weeks after the first movie.
Oh, okay. Oh, well, I'm down for it. I mean, I really remember enjoying the first one. I probably would like to go back and revisit it.
I mean, there are some fantastic scenes in that first movie. Edna Mode, the really short superhero costume designer.
Yeah.
Is one of my favorite characters in any superhero movie. Yeah. Her montage with no capes was so fantastic. It was a brilliant movie.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's definitely one to watch. I assume coming out next year, Stu?
Yeah, and we're going to be getting trailers dropping probably around the same time as Deadpool.
Well, I'll be so interested to see what the box office on this is like, too, because, I mean...
It's going
to
be big.
Everybody loves The Incredibles.
I mean, this is Disney's animation at its best.
Is it going to be a Finding Dory situation, though, where Finding Nemo was so amazing? I haven't seen Finding Dory yet.
Neither have I. I haven't.
I love Finding Nemo so much, though.
Finding Nemo was a great film.
What was the box office take on Finding Dory? Was it? Can you?
It was big. It was massive.
It was big. Okay. Well, I'm thinking because that movie had like such good word about the first one and did so well, but so much time had passed. I was just wondering what the box office take, because I imagine it's going to be a similar situation for Incredibles. Very similar movie, beloved, 10 years later.
So, I mean, Finding Dory took just over $1
billion. Ka-ching, really?
Yeah, $1.029 billion.
That answers my question.
So, I mean, massive.
That answers my question. And you know another movie that took about $1 billion that came out 10 years later or more was Jurassic World. You know, that movie made so much money. Remember how surprised everyone was by the Jurassic World take?
Yeah.
But a similar situation where a beloved first movie, a lot of times passed, you know, it comes back and the franchise just lit up. Well, that's,
but I mean, look,
I think a really good...
Look, 10 years ago, the superhero bubble was just starting.
Yeah.
So 10 years ago was Iron Man 1. That came out 10 years ago.
God.
So this was just around the same time and it took, I think, just over $600 million from memory.
That's plenty.
Which was a huge hit for an animated film, which didn't cost a lot of money to make.
Exactly.
This movie is posed to make a lot more. This has the potential to be another $1 billion animated film.
Okay, cool.
It has the potential to be another Finding Dory. But this has got some of the best superhero characters, some of the greatest voice actors as well.
Dude, you're making me think I want to go back and watch it again because I've only seen it once, you know, years ago. I really, really enjoyed it. I mean, it's a really good movie. I'd recommend, kids, if you haven't seen Incredibles, go check it out, and then definitely Incredibles 2. And I will, after the show, Stu, I will take time out of my busy schedule and check out Incredibles 2 teaser trailer as well, because that actually sounded pretty cool what you described.
The other thing is they've said that they've got a couple of new actors to come in. They don't know who's playing the villain yet.
Sure.
So the villain's still kind of under wraps. Oh, they could do so much
with it, couldn't they?
But what they've got is Bob Odenkirk has signed on.
Oh, really?
So Better Call Saul is a voice actor in this.
Yay! I'm happy.
Film. So we don't know if he's playing the villain yet.
He's got a good voice, too.
He's got a great voice.
Mm. I tell you who'd play a good villain as well, his brother. You know, the guy who plays his brother in Better Call Saul. He's also got an excellent voice, that actor. What a show Better Call Saul is. Love that show.
The crazy brother.
I'm ready for season four. Now, Stu, some stuff about Bendis. Obviously, his recall, he's leaving DC.
Mm-hmm.
For DC, sorry. Leaving Marvel for DC. For DC. And he had questions on his Tumblr, like people throw questions at him and stuff. And one of the questions was he going to be doing issue 600 of Iron Man? And he responded, not only am I writing issue 600 of Iron Man, but it is a substantially larger issue. And I think it will be actually be my last Marvel comic. In many ways, on many levels, it's kind of the perfect end to my time. I am generally looking at this Spider-Man 240 and Spider-Man 2 number 5 as my final thesis statements.
I mean, it's going to be a massive ending to a long and steady career at Marvel.
Definitely. Huge.
I love the idea that he's taking Iron Man 600 as his, like, farewell card.
No, I think it's good. I think it's classy.
It is.
On behalf of Marvel and him to wrap it up properly because, let's face it, these will be huge selling issues for Marvel anyway. Much better than just burning the bridge completely. Let Bendis close it out. They can hype it to the max, squeeze it for every dollar.
Yep.
And he's leaving out of the door anyway. There's nothing they can do about that.
No, exactly.
And then
let him go out in a high, though.
Have some
good blood.
That seems to
I
be
feel like Marvel of late has been too embroiled in bad blood.
Sure.
Like, they, you know, they're taking comics off the shelves just so they don't promote characters they don't own.
Yeah.
They've been feeling negative in a lot of press statements.
Yeah. Well, we've already covered their Wolverine things that I'm not a fan of.
So I like the fact that they're letting Bendis go out in a big issue on a high note.
I make this comment, I'm available. If they need I imagine he's left a.
If they need someone to pitch large table discussions and scantily clad women, Dave's available.
I know. I mean, if they want someone on Punisher titles, I'm available to do it. You know, yeah. I mean, yeah, throw characters at me. I mean, there's plenty of characters I'd like to do. But, I mean, in all.
Captain Marvel? We need a.
No.
There we go.
Marvel? No, thanks.
Marvel is very dead at this point.
I'm not even slightly interested in the original, digging up the original corpse of Marvel. I know Captain Marvel title is, I'm sure, in good hands because it's certainly a property they've invested a lot of time in that's done quite well for them.
And it's about to become bigger, yeah.
Exactly. Sure, it's time for Weekly Comics!
It's short list this week.
It's a short list.
We had a lot of Punisher to read. We had a lot of Punisher to watch. Yeah.
Dave had a lot on his plate.
I'm so glad it's a short list.
Do you like that one of them is the one I reviewed for that universe?
I did notice that this is just a lazy review from Dave.
I've already done a review about the universe.
Let's start with the lazy one. Then.
Okay, listen. We'll keep the lazy one on first.
Kick it off. Harley Quinn
32, which is a good one though. It wraps up the storyline of Harley for Mayor. And basically,
yeah. So this isn't a story that I've read the first half of.
Oh, haven't you?
No, this is a
just coming in.
Last Harley.
Well,
I think
the review copies from DC. I don't know what you're doing.
I know the last Harley I read. I think was 28, 29.
Okay,
well, a little while ago.
Not that much has changed, dude. Like,
no, not a lot has changed.
She's running for mayor. I'll give you the crib notes. She's been running for mayor. She was doing very well actually, but the corrupt mayor has been really going against her. Unfortunately, at the end of and spoilers, kids. At the end of...
I love how much it pains you to say that.
It really does. It
like, Dave grimaces every time he's like, oh, spoilers.
I just think it's everything...
Like, you disgust me if you haven't read this already.
It's wrong with today's culture. That children...
It has been available for purchase for 7 days.
So entitled.
How dare you not have read this?
Well, the fact that I have to pretend like I'm so fucking worried about it, like... But anyway, that aside, so at the end of last episode, spoilers, Mason gets shot in the head and killed, which is Harley's boyfriend, and this picks up just after that. So this,
yeah, actually, so that was a surprise. That was something that I hadn't.
Yeah.
I was okay.
I also enjoyed that as well. I thought that would be a bit of a surprise for you, just kind of coming in, kind of fresh, just
completely blind. Yeah.
And so Harley's on kind of a vengeance quest with Harley Sin. And what I enjoyed about this issue was she really does take a vengeance. This one had less of the comedic Harley and more of the vengeance-fueled Harley, because she really is rightly kind of pissed at the mayor. You know, again, I gave it 4.5 stars on Batman Universe. Is it enjoyable issue of Harley again? Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor have the tone of Harley just down so pat perfectly.
Yeah, I enjoyed Harley in this. It was a fun issue. Harley was even making jokes when she was like coming in for the kill at the end.
Oh, and she does that, yeah, of course.
Leaving him for Madame Macabre.
Oh, yeah, just to torture him.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then she just walks out with the body and Red Tool's with her. And they just roll out.
There are a few scenes that were a bit on the nose. Overall, I gave it a 7 out of 10. Enjoyable issue.
Yeah, very enjoyable.
I didn't understand the first half because I hadn't read the others.
But I sort of thought that might be the case, but then I thought, excuse me, big boy.
It's not bad, even when you don't understand what's going on.
By the way, winning the mayor race, and then he basically took Mason hostage and was holding him saying, you have to withdraw or I'll kill him. So she was actually doing very well in the mayor race.
Gotcha.
And she sort of, like, remember too that Palmiotti and Amanda Connor are leaving the title, at least temporarily, and Frank Terry's coming on to ride Harley. I'm not sure if this is the last issue, but I think there might be a couple more issues of Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor's run. Then they're handing the baton over to his mate, Frank Terry. So that'll be interesting. So I'm really looking forward to that as well. And I've been chatting to Frank, and we're going to have him on the show before too long as well.
Excellent.
So, you know, the sequel's just becoming bigger, starting to dominate the world. I mean, Kevin Smith's probably a bit worried. He's probably stoned, a little worried about the Signal of Doom's, you know.
I feel like he's more stoned than worried.
Sure he's.
At any time. Literally any time, day or night.
When he's not weeping over fucking Flash episodes or something as well.
When he's not crying or shaking his hands, he's just very stoned.
Do you find the whole weeping thing just bizarre? Like, it's like,
I don't know, he's a man in touch with his emotions. Let's let him be.
I'm in touch with my emotions, but I'm not weeping.
Dave, you're barely in touch with your emotions. I think your emotions are. What do we have? We have.
Pissed off.
We have pissed off. We have tired. We have sleepy Dave.
Yeah, tired. Hangry Dave.
We have feisty Dave. We have.
Yeah, definitely.
Hangry Dave.
I have emotions, man. Distaste.
Most of your emotions revolve around internet debates, thoughts on women and food. Like,
yeah, you've covered it. And the cricket.
And the cricket, of course, yeah.
Anyway. Fascinating though that explanation of my character is we've actually got a big one this week, Doomsday Clock 1 by Jeff Johns and I think Gary Frank on fantastic art.
The artwork is brilliant.
The art in this is brilliant.
Really and good.
Just to bring readers up to speed, this is a 12-part maxi series written by Jeff Johns and Gary Frank on drawing duties. And it's basically a sequel to Watchmen, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
And it's been billed as a crossover event between the Watchmen universe and the DC universe. So it ties into the whole thing that seems to have been going on in the Superman titles.
Yeah, and let's be honest, we only got a very brief glimpse of Superman in this.
But still, it's in the same comic.
Issue.
Whereas the original Watchmen by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons was very much in its own universe.
Oh, it was very isolated, yeah.
And they've teased since Rebirth a connection with Watchmen.
Yeah.
The biggest one being the button, I guess, Stu. The comedian's button in...
With Flash, yeah.
Yeah, and it was in Batman's cave and all that kind of stuff. So they've sort of teased it, and this is now paying it off in 12 issues, which it is as well. Watchmen originally was 12 issues. So, interestingly enough, Stu, before you even get into the discussion, I asked, given that it's the Watchmen sequel, I asked Jim at King's Comics, because, Sydney's premier comic destination, Stu. I asked Jim if this was going to be the biggest, thing for him month-wise, order-wise.
Yeah.
I sort of wanted to know how big was this for him. I said, does this be Batman or whatever the
biggest... I mean, that's a big call. When you compare everything to Batman...
Well, yeah.
And if it's beating Batman, it's a big deal.
I compare everything to Batman. And I said to Jim, and so here's his response, which he said I could read out. Easily. We've got more pre-orders for Doomsday Clock than most of Marvel's top-tier titles, and that's just in store. Chucking out online pre-orders and issue one will easily beat the main Batman title by a mile. The new 12-parter doesn't seem to have the same stigma that before Watchmen books had. Maybe it's because it's not technically an official sequel to Watchmen. Maybe it's because Alan Moore sent his bid, didn't complain about it. Who knows? Either way, it's got some super sweet art by Gary Frank, and I'm all over it. On also helps that issue one has a lenticular Rorschach cover. Our pre-orders for that edition are just nuts. And then he also went on to say, he said probably if they named the series Justice League versus Watchmen, then Fan Fury would have hit fever pitch. DC did the smart thing here, which I agree with.
Yeah.
They let it be known that this is heavily tied into Watchmen without saying, this is, you know, Dr. Manhattan versus Superman, making it seem exactly. super fucking cheesy.
No, they went the classy route with this. Yeah. They went more nuanced, and it works.
And like I said, so getting into the issue itself, Stu, which was interesting, it's really a setting place issue, not a stack happens. It really does take place after the original Watchmen. Ozymandias is on the run.
So it picks off with Rorschach.
Yeah.
Running through a prison, picking up the puppeteer. It was the marionette.
Marionette and Mr. Mime. Mr. Mime, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Two characters I wasn't super fond of, frankly.
No, neither, but I really love the scene where he goes to his locker to get his tools.
Yeah, what did he get? I didn't quite understand what he got.
The locker was empty. He was miming it. He mimed putting on a belt and holstering a weapon.
Okay.
It was just... I thought that was really fun.
I've always found lame as fuck.
No, I thought that was really, really good. I really enjoyed that little bit.
I thought he picked up something really small, and I just couldn't actually see what it was.
No, because you saw like Rorschach just like, oh.
Yeah, and I'm the same.
Like, I should have seen this coming. When he reaches into the empty locker.
Rorschach, I feel for your pain.
Clips on his little imaginary belt.
Got it.
And then at the end, he unholsters the imaginary gun and points it at Rorschach's head.
Full on villains, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, these two guys were villains.
Real villains, and he really came to get the marionette.
Yeah.
But she insisted that she pick up.
She basically said, I don't leave without my husband.
Yeah.
And my husband doesn't leave without his stuff.
And he was like, fine, let's get the husband.
Yeah.
Who's just a loose fucking unit himself.
Yeah.
I did like the scene where he was getting beat up. She's like, oh, no, let him play out the act. He likes to be the underdog and then kick their ass.
Yeah, again, he's getting the crap beaten out of him and then all of a sudden it flips.
Meanwhile, the world's gone to hell. There's like a full narrative about where the world is in a pretty bad place.
Yeah, so the US and Russia are about to go into full-on war. Russia's invaded.
North Korea's doing something.
North Korea can now send missiles into Texas.
I kind of find that annoying. North Korea, to me, is this piece of shit country that we should nuke off the fucking planet. Like, and do you really think that this huge threat, Stu? Like, or, you know, could we just terminate with extreme prejudice?
I mean, it depends how political you want to get, but...
Just say what you fucking like.
North Korea does have nuclear capabilities. They have the potential to send a nuke, not to America. That's not the threat here.
They were sending them over the Japan Sea or something.
The threat is they could send it into, like, somewhere like South Korea and hit Seoul, where 10 million people live.
Okay, so they've got that capacity.
I mean, they could annihilate 10 million people in the blink of an eye.
My question more, though, was Geoff Johns saying that they've already done that, or just saying the missiles could reach that
far? Well, this is in this doomsday kind of universe, where all this shit has already happened, and they're saying that they are sending missiles... Well, have the potential to send missiles into the heart of Texas.
Okay, got it. Okay, fair enough. I just wanted to clarify that because I wasn't sure. So basically,
but there's world war erupting.
Everything.
Governments have collapsed. They said the president had just killed the Secretary of State.
Do we
something.
Have a date on this? Do we know how long it is since Watchmen? Do they say that?
I think they might have said a year.
I was just wondering that as well. If it was in real time, I mean. I don't know. Maybe I think they did say how long Ozymandias had been on the run. It might have been 10 years or something. Because if you recall, kids, at the end of Watchmen, Ozymandias is exposed because of Rorschach's journal, isn't he, Stu?
Yeah, and that is one of the reveals in this comic that Ozymandias is working with Rorschach, the new Rorschach, which again is another reveal.
Okay, and so this new Rorschach is basically, if you recall, at the end of Watchmen, Rorschach is killed. Yes, Stu? Basically, because he knew too much.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't compromise.
We know that Rorschach has been killed.
Yes.
But in this universe, the rumors are that Rorschach went crazy, killed the other members of the Watchmen, and then committed suicide.
Yes.
But so, like, the marionette...
His journal exposes Ozymandias.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, his character's talking to the marionette, and she's saying, didn't you kill Silk Spectre, and you killed... It wasn't Ozymandias. I can't remember the other character's name.
Night Owl.
Yeah, he killed a bunch of people and then just committed suicide.
Night Owl's his old partner, who's nowhere to be seen. Although they are at his old base in this episode.
Yeah, they've got the big... Owlmobile, what's it called?
Yeah, the Owl. I don't know what it's called, but yeah, the Owlmobile will do for me. Stu, can I figure my theory? Because I've got a theory, and I've actually got a good feeling I'm going to be right. Okay, it's my theory about Rorschach.
Okay.
Here's my theory, Stu, and people, no one's said it yet, only me. I think it's Rorschach from an alternate universe that Ozymandias has picked up. That's what I think. So I think the fact that it's a black Rorschach, it is Rorschach, but it's just not from the Watchmen universe, and it's kind of tying into the other universes, like Superman waking up in the normal Rebirth universe. I think it's just Rorschach. So it is Rorschach, but just not from that universe.
See, I feel like it's definitely going to be a big character, one that we know.
Well,
and it's going to be
what characters do you know, dude? From fucking
well, Watchmen. It's going to be some kind of reveal that they're going to have that.
Oh, you mean like
it's
a DC
not
character.
It's not Rorschach. It's going to be some other character that's put on the mask.
A DC character, though.
Yeah,
like Mr. Terrific or something.
Yeah,
I mean, how many black famous characters do you know from DC? Like, how many?
There's certainly not many.
Mr. I think Terrific, that's... Black Lightning. I mean, there's some, but I'm talking about famous. You're talking about famous. So I think it's going to just be Rorschach from alternate universe, and this guy's been zipping around different universes. That would kind of fit in with some of the stuff.
I think the only problem with that is that why would he choose to be living in this universe which is collapsing in on itself, trying to find Dr. Manhattan to fix it when he's capable of interdimensional travel? And he could just go back to his home universe and escape all the problems.
To every single thing in the whole story, Stu. I just have my own theory.
The only problem with the whole universe traveling, time traveling kind of aspect is he's there for the long haul. Like, he's trying to fix it.
Well, maybe Doctor.
And if that's not his universe, there's no incentive for him to fix it.
But it was just the way he kept insisting, "No, I am Rorschach." He was saying, "No, I am Rorschach."
Yeah, but I feel like that's just a delusion that he's living in.
Okay, fair enough.
Like, I'm wearing the mask, I am Rorschach.
Which would be the more commonly embraced notion anyway. That's probably the more likely thing.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, well...
I mean, who knows? Look, it might just be a random person that decided to put on the mask
just once Rorschach... Just person C who inherited the mask from the old Rorschach somehow, and is just equally crazy.
Yeah.
You know, they seem pretty fucking crazy.
Oh, they absolutely seem batshit crazy.
Yeah, I mean, Rorschach is a pretty disturbed individual. Anyway, look, as an issue, that's kind of all that happens, though. They wind up back at Ozymandias' thing, and they're just talking a bit. Flashes to Superman briefly. I did have a question about Superman. He's in bed with Lois, dreaming of his parents dying. Did his parents die in a car crash? Well, I didn't know. I wasn't even aware Ma and Pa Kent were both dead.
They didn't both die in a car crash.
Well, they did in the dream.
They did in the dream, which I think is a crossover of different reality kind of thing.
Right. So is that Superman from this...
Well, he kind of wakes up screaming, and Lois is kind of saying the whole room was shaking, you know, you're breaking down the building. And Superman does say this is the first nightmare he's ever had.
But what my question is that... Did that happen to Superman? And is this Superman the regular Superman? That was my question.
Possibly. I don't know the answer. I feel like instead of a dream, this was a vision that was sent to him.
Got it. Okay.
Because he did say, I've never had a nightmare before. This is a whole new thing for me.
And I believe that in Superman comics, Jor-El was exposed as being Mr. Oz, which is a behind-the-scenes character that's been going on in Rebirth, the character that, like, took back Tim Drake, etc., etc. And there was speculation that Mr. Oz was going to be Ozymandias. But it looks like Ozymandias is here, just like we normally would see him, Adrian Veitch, or whatever his name is.
Well, they're the same character.
Mm. Yeah, but Mr. Oz was speculated to be Ozymandias, but then was revealed to be Jor-El, so it could have been a red herring on DC's part.
It could have been, and that's the way they seem to be playing this whole event.
Mm.
It seems to be that they're leading you down one path just to show you that it's not that person.
Yeah. Look, I mean, you're going to stick around for 12 issues. I am, but I'm sort of like, I thought this was good. I didn't think it was great. I thought it was decent set up, but...
See, look, I feel like at the moment it's a solid start, but it's not great.
I'd agree.
I think going forward you'd want to have it pick up significantly in the next 2 or 3 issues.
Do you think that's part of the problem is, okay, Geoff Johns is a very good writer, but he's definitely not Alan Moore in terms of style, but he's definitely trying to mimic and sort of channel that style.
Yeah, which is a pity because it doesn't... It's not the best thing that he does. It's not what he does best.
No, Geoff Johns' style isn't particularly very similar to Alan Moore's style. Normally.
So I feel like, unfortunately, we're not getting Alan Moore at his prime.
No.
We're not getting Geoff Johns at his prime.
No.
Like, both are great writers, both have a style.
Yeah, they're just quite different.
And what we're getting here is neither.
Yeah, and but
it feels like we've missed an opportunity.
It's kind of like any good writer is going, okay, give me your best Alan Moore, and he's kind of going, okay, here it is. And then you're like, yeah, it's okay. Like,
it's an average impression.
Yeah, that's thank you, Stuart.
And he's better off using his own voice and his own flavor, I think.
Could it just be, though, like as Jim is saying in King's Comics, this is a huge money spinner, and DC just are like, fuck it, we're going to tap this world real dry.
It's definitely a money spinner.
Yeah. And I'm not sitting here going, oh, that's horrible. Like, I mean, that's capitalism, kids. But it's just, I just wanted to get your sort of take on where you were critically. Because for me, it's a 7 out of 10, Stu. It's not much more than that. It looked beautiful. Beautiful.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. It's 7 out of 10 for me.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, so that really was, Stu, was that, was the all of our weekly comics this week, wasn't it?
Yeah, two of them. A lazy pick and a brand new exciting pick.
Yeah, exactly. I did have another comic that was on the register, which neither of us read because I forgot about it. I did pick up, Stu, actually. They're re-releasing... this was something I was talking to Jim about as well. They're re-releasing all of Jack Kirby stuff. So I got Jack Kirby's The Demon series and also Jack Kirby's Mr. Miracle.
So okay.
It's reprints from, like, the... I guess the start of the 70s when he came over to DC from Marvel.
Yeah.
So I got... Very reasonably priced. I got 20% off. And I got both of those things, which I'm going to read at some point. And I believe both of those are included in the... I think both, at least one of them, are included in the DC sale on Comixology.
Nice.
That sale is incredible. I mean, I'm going to hit that sale after the show because it expires at on Saturday, US time. So it's still going now. And it really is a good sale. Anyway, Stu, so that covers weekly comics, which leads us into, finally, Stu... The Punisher War Journal by Carl Potts and Jim Lee.
And let's be honest here. I didn't get the whole thing done.
Well, no, I made it to about page 400 myself. So
I got through, I believe it's 8 issues. I'm not 100% sure.
You said to the end of the Wolverine.
We got the double Wolverine issue where they're in the jungle trying to find some dinosaurs.
Yep.
I got through that, and then that's where I stopped. I thought that was a really nice place to stop.
It's a good place.
Because I thought the next was like a 3 or 4 issue run.
Yep, yep. Oh, I mean, dude, I've got, like, I just want to set the scene here. Flashback to very late 80s, a very, very moody teenage Dave, a young Dave, very young guy, pretty problematic in a lot of ways in terms of my angst-ridden mood, and Punisher was just like heaven to me. And I read the original Punisher by Mike Baron. I probably read that the first 15 issues or so, which I'd come into, and I read them all, just devoured them. And then they launched this, dude, Punisher War Journal on better paper. Carl Potts, who'd been the editor of all the early Punisher titles in the rebirth of Punisher in like 86. So he was the editor, and he's the editor that a lot of these writers swear by. And he was like, he was on writing duties with Jim Lee, fresh on the scene at Marvel, just before he did his X-Men run. Burst onto the scene with his incredible art, and it blew me away. And I, for me, this is one of these moments where it's just like the perfect distillation of Punisher at that time. There is, it's Punisher looks, one thing that, this is always how I think Punisher looks. People always do Punisher now as older, like Ennis always did him as older and more weather-beaten, but this is quite a heroic looking Punisher, isn't it, Stu?
This is Punisher in his prime.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, we're seeing a Punisher that, for me, seems early 30s.
Sure, yeah.
That has had a career in the military.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not in his 20s. He's not young.
No, he's not a young gun. He's like 30s. So, yeah.
But he seems early 30s. He's still in the prime. He's built.
And it's all set up. You've got Microchip back in the base. This is what I love about it, Stu. You've got the battle van. You've got Microchip in the base. And Frank just taking out crack houses left, right, and center. Nice storyline in this one, Stewie goes down to Central Park every year.
Yeah.
To fly the kite because it's the year anniversary of when his wife and family were killed. And in this storyline, he meets up with, I think, is it Hector Montoya? Another jailbird that he met in the prison. I think they share a scene, Circle of Blood. And you kind of get the building of a Hector story, which kind of crosses paths with Frank Castle's story in terms of the slaying in the park.
Yeah, and they're portrayed as these kind of almost equal figures in prison.
Yep.
One which has taken the kind of the moral high ground in that they only kills criminals.
Sure.
The other one's on the low ground. He is a criminal.
He had a dirty past, but sort of has a bit of nobility about him as well.
Yeah, so they're both these kind of mixed figures.
Yeah.
Same build, Yep. Both in prison together, and they both kind of nod and respect each other.
Yeah.
Kind of this begrudging
and
respect.
And when they come out, something or other happens. Basically, Hector's still taking people out using these letter poisoning. I always like that touch. Like, he sends letters to his
that was a little
enemies.
Yeah, and if you touch it, you die.
Yeah, and it becomes a big plot point. Because, unfortunately, it eventually gets him in the end.
Well, Frank gets hit by it.
Yeah.
Ends up having to get some medical help.
But Hector as well, unfortunately, falls in the end.
They throw a vat in his face, don't they?
And then, he's like, I'm going to get back to my family because he loves his family. And then he just gets gunned down by the cops. one thing I've got to say here is Carl Potts, for me, how about the scene, dude, where the reporter with the cocaine... Love it.
Yeah, that was really aggressive, wasn't it?
It was fantastic.
The reporter just casually pulls out a bit of coke and is like, hey, you want to do a line with me?
Not to Frank, but one of his old war mates. And this guy just fucking reacts.
Rips her down.
If all you snowflakes did something more constructive to get your kicks and then gives her like an anti-drug lecture.
Yeah.
Tell you what, as a 13-year-old, I stood up and paid fucking attention. Because the big thing in the 80s, Stu, was just say no to drugs. And I was always like, yeah. Like, fucking just say no. Like, seriously, it's not that hard.
I thought you meant you were just like, yes to drugs.
No, yeah. I was the exact opposite. I was a very straight-laced kid, and I took all this really seriously. What happened? Oh, I had a brief phase in the 90s when I got into marijuana very briefly, but not too long. But what I love is Punisher. At the start of one of the issues, one of the quotes, she was taking out that crack house took longer than planned. He's constantly on the roll from taking out crack houses. Now, I don't know if they really were as big a problem in the late 80s as like Punisher comics make them out to be.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but it was a nice cannon fodder for a Punisher fan.
Yeah, but Punisher just takes them out constantly. Micro's always telling him he needs to chill out a little bit, needs to relax, you've got to burn yourself out, Frank. I like what Micro said, pretty soon you won't be able to stand seeing a litter bug without pumping some 9mm rounds in his direction.
And at that point, Micro was like, all right, you need to take a break.
I've got just to the trip for you down in Africa.
Yeah, let's just send you on a casual trip to Africa. And Punisher being Punisher finds a new war in Africa.
Yeah. He's kind of, they do the sort of Agatha Christie sort of people on a plane where everyone on the African trip, you know, they've kind of got like the scientist and they've got his wife and they've got this person.
Yeah, and they've got the hunter and they've got the guide and they've got the translator.
And Fred just constantly runs into trouble. Yeah. The trial of some dinosaurs, which I thought was cool.
Yeah, so there's this lost tribe of dinosaurs living somewhere deep in the jungle.
Yeah.
And there is a big game hunter.
Yeah.
That is paying $1 million for the head of any one of these things.
Yeah, he wants to
it's the only thing he's left in his collection.
Yep.
So he sent out a bunch of poachers that are going to take them out.
And a scientist who genuinely thinks they're just there to study them.
Yeah.
But his wife is just a ditzy little, she's out for the cash.
Yeah, she's big there for the money. And Frank's just going along with them as their security.
Security, yeah. Frank's just like, fine, I'll take this stupid job for my because the scientist is an old friend of Micro's.
Yeah.
And I like what Frank's like. The wife's all over him. I have to wonder if it's genuine. Like, Frank's just straight away.
Yeah, he's basically like, yeah, she's out of his league. What the hell is she doing here?
And then basically also in the side story, Wolverine.
Yeah.
Did you like this Wolverine appearance, Stu?
It was a good Wolverine.
I thought it was pretty good, man. Yeah.
I love the way that Frank kept talking about him as like the... Hairy Runt. Hairy Runt. Yeah. Because
Frank just, as usual, is not up to date on his X-Men knowledge at all.
No, even when he pops the claws, he's still got no idea who he is.
I don't think Frank, at this point, had any sort of interest or knowledge of the
X-Men. At that point, Frank's like, ooh, he's got knives.
Yeah, Frank just didn't react at all to
Not at all. And I was like, really? You're not going to say...
He gave Wolverine a massive haymaker, which landed, and then basically sort of break his knuckles due to Wolverine's adamantium, like, jaw.
Yeah, and he still didn't tweak that this guy wasn't human.
No, he didn't. He never really tweaked to it. He thought he killed him, I think, at one point. And
he said something like it's pretty hard to put you down.
because Wolverine's in Madripoor and he basically smells like a game hunter or something, and he's got cheetah skins and stuff in his truck, which is obviously highly illegal. And so Wolverine takes him out and then goes down, trakes it down to the jungle where he bumps into Punisher, etc., and he's wearing the cheetah as a cloak.
Well, I mean, Wolverine is trying to track down the poachers.
Yes.
That running this illegal ring.
Yeah.
And he's wearing one of the cheetah's cloaks.
I always liked that touch.
The idea originally was that so he can pretend to be one of these poachers so that he can just walk into their camp.
More a stylistic choice.
And it was just a stylistic choice. So he's going hunting for some poachers, and he comes across Punisher and says, well, this guy must be a poacher.
Yeah, he thinks Punisher's
this guy's a big dumb brute with a giant gun. He's definitely hunting.
Firing off shots everywhere.
Meanwhile, Punisher sees him and's like, oh, that must be the guy I'm here to kill.
She just basically just goes straight into, like, who the fuck is this guy?
So the two of them just fight. It's
a classic fight in the sense of...
classic Marvel in that both of them just walk in and go, that guy, and just start fighting.
But it's also without the let's team up. It's just like...
Yeah, I was expecting the last panel to be like, let's team up and go for another issue.
It's kind of like Frank and Wolverine are just too grumpy to team up. They sort of... There's a moment where Frank's just like, oh, we're both dupes, because he realizes, like... Did you see when he gunned the chick down when she was running away?
Yeah.
He just gunned her down.
Yeah. He just put three rounds in her back.
And also, it's almost off panel. So you're like, oh, that's what happened to her. I see. And then the other guy just runs across. I think he gets eaten by a dinosaur or something, doesn't he? Or something. He gets eaten by something.
So the other guy that runs away, Wolverine finds him first.
Oh, does he? Okay.
But then basically, like, no, hang on.
He gets hurt. I'm not sure exactly what happens to
Punisher
him.
Punisher shoots him in the knee.
Right, yeah, so he's wounded.
So he's wounded. He gets tracked down by Wolverine,
mm-hmm.
who basically says, no, it's not worth my time.
Sure.
Punisher then comes along, takes the cloak, the cheetah skin cloak, and binds his wounds.
Right.
Which basically ties him up an angry team of gorillas coming after them.
Yeah, because they've been killing
gorillas. And the gorillas attack these cheetahs on sight.
Yeah.
He's just, like, laced him up in this leopard skin.
Frank is sort of...
So the gorillas are going to, like, destroy him.
I like the way Frank's, like, it's almost like you're not worth a bullet.
Yeah.
Like...
And then the last panel, you just see this dinosaur, like, crush the bones years later as it walks past.
Yeah. It's like that, all right, kids, the dinosaurs are still okay.
Yeah.
I kind of dug the dinosaur angle, actually. I thought that was kind of fairly inventive.
Yeah, like normally you see them connected with like the Savage Land and
this was
Kazaar comics and things like that. And this is a nice
sort of, you know, hidden aspect of Africa. One thing that really impressed me is Carl Potts is actually a really good writer. And I kept reading it and I realized I hadn't read it. There's a crossover issue later between Punisher and Bushwhacker. Marvel did a thing around this period called Acts of Vengeance.
Yep.
And Acts of Vengeance idea was, okay, say you got one of Daredevil's villains like Bushwhacker. He's an obscure Daredevil villain. Well, Doctor Doom and Kingpin were having some sort of competition, and they were throwing everyone's different foes against another random hero. So Punisher got... That was actually the idea. It was kind of like, you always get beaten by this hero. How about if I throw your villain against this guy and sort of swap it around? So it sounds lame, but actually the issue with Punisher...
It's always something like all the readers of these comics go, why don't they just fight someone else?
Yeah.
Like, why do you keep fighting the same guy that beats you every time?
Exactly. And then so in this one, Punisher came against Bushwhacker. Bushwhacker is just a crazy unit. He's got a scarred face. It's kind of funny. With his arm, he can form it into a gun. And he's got this wife who just gives him so much shit because she's like, you used to be a priest. Then you were... Because Frank was also a priest.
Of course. So I
was like, you used to be a priest. Then you
But were, I thought that was like retconned into his backstory, wasn't it?
What?
Frank being a priest.
Well, it was definitely when Carl Potts was writing this, it was definitely part of his story. Like Mike Baron built that.
But like I thought originally he was just military, and then let's just write him in as a priest for a few years.
I think Mike Baron wrote him in as a priest in the '80s.
It was kind of retconning his origin story.
Oh yeah, in the first issue of Punisher, he's not a priest,
but he never has been.
No, but Mike Baron built it in when he got the solo title,
and then they kind of ran with a religious vibe for a little while.
Yeah, there's a few stories. It's primarily just his backstory.
That was the vibe at Marvel at the time, because Daredevil had exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
He always had Christian guilt,
Frank's
but they kind of...
not quite as tortured.
It's funny that, yeah.
Yeah, it's more that they use it as backstory a bit. I think there's a Mike Baron story where they really explore it. But in this one, it's more of a coincidence. This guy is a priest, and apparently he knows Frank was a priest.
Yeah,
the funniest part, though, Stu, is the wife, because she's just absolutely had it up to here with this guy. And then also Punisher crashing into a house. And then Punisher just says, you live, aid, and abet an assassin for hire. You're no angel. That's what he informs her when she when she's telling him to get out of the house. Micro says, you're letting your life be ruled by your compulsions. It makes you predictable and vulnerable.
because he's going back down to the anniversary, and he's going, you shouldn't go to the anniversary. You attracted so much heat last year with Hector Montoya.
Yeah.
And then Frank's like, no, I'm going to go down anyway. Got to, you know, my wife and family got killed in Central Park. I've got to, like, you know, celebrate it or mourn it. And, but then he goes down the cycle, but then he actually doesn't stop. He goes, actually, I've got a weird vibe, Micah, I might be right. And he goes back to the safe house, and this bushwhacker guy trails him back. And they have quite a good battle. It's pretty funny, actually. Frank, in the end, kills him. The guy keeps asking for confession. And like, he wants to confess his crimes. And he's on the bridge. And Frank's just there, kind of with his...
stamping on his ass.
Yeah, but then Frank's just like, any last confessions of the guy saying something or other. And Frank doesn't say, like, request deny, but something very similar to that. You missed a Hail Mary and kicks him off. I mean, this is, to me... Carl Potts had a great sense of what attracted Punisher in that era. To me, it's still the best Punisher era. Frank is devoid of the emotional capacity that we see in the show. Would you agree, Stu? It's a fairly more black and white Frank Castle.
Yeah, the show for me is far more nuanced than this book.
Mm.
This book is very black and white Frank.
Mm.
Find a target, track it, kill it, move on to the next target.
Any humanity is left to Micro trying to pull him back in.
Yeah, Micro's trying to coax him back to humanity.
Yeah.
And Frank's just unresponsive.
Yeah, he's just...
It's for him, it's just, who's my next target?
His interior monologue is just... It's kind of dry, isn't it? Like, Mike Barron always had him dry with a touch of humor. Carl Potts almost distills the humor out and makes Frank almost robotic.
Yeah, I mean, the humor's certainly left to the other characters.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no emotion other than hatred coming out of Frank.
Mm,
hatred and, I suppose, I don't know, boredom.
Yeah, he has a warped sense of justice. Like, it is quite routine for him to talk about these crack houses. I've got a quote here. It works, though. I've got a quote here where he's just driving away, doing something, and he sees these two gangs. He goes, two drug gangs slaughtering each other in a turf war. I'll let them kill each other off. Wonder when the authorities will really do something to combat the gang mentality. And he just drives off, and these two gangs are fighting. Like, it really is an insight into a very disconnected guy. And I find it a kind of a commentary on the times, like, because as a young guy, I lapped it up. I mean, I was a fairly isolated teenager, and I was always like, Frank's seeing things that people just aren't seeing. And now I look back at it, and I'm like, I dig it. I still like it a lot. But I'm wondering if the crime epidemic was as high as what Frank Castle was kind of pushing. I mean, that's something I'd like to ask a guy like Mike Barron or Chuck. Like, did you guys have to inflate the sense of, like, literally outside your door you could be? Because I always had that feeling as a kid. Like, my mother instilled in me, like, it's happening. You could walk outside and be killed, sort of thing. Like, if you go
this was
out,
in Tasmania,
if you go
as
out
well.
Late at night and stuff, like, yeah, it's weird to think about. But there is violence on the streets, Stu. I mean, I've been around, like, late at nights and stuff, and when alcohol gets involved and all sorts of things, there is violence is around in our society, but. I mean, it's
nowhere near as prevalent as what this comic makes it.
No, that's what I'm saying.
This is certainly a
hyper-realism, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Mm. This is taking it to the nth degree.
I mean, because one thing Chuck does in his comics is he even strips away, he gives Frank some of the sarcastic humor back, but he blows out the situation even more. Carl Potts kind of grounds it. Like, there's that stuff with the armory, you know, every issue, Stu. You get the armory updates and stuff, which for me has always been a slight bit of a yawn, but the real hardcore Punisher fans out there really love the armory sort of angle and the weapons that he uses. Like the ballistic knife where he shoots it off the blade into the stomach. That's a good old one from Frank. It often comes down to the knife, just the knife left. I don't know, Stu. I mean, this is... What would you give this from what you read out of the issues?
For me, it's a 7 out of 10.
It's a high score for you on a Punisher
title. It's good for Punisher. It's not the best Punisher I've read.
No.
I still think Welcome Back Frank is a better run for me.
Welcome Back Frank's very strong.
But this is right up there. I'd actually be interested to read the second half.
Yeah.
At some stage.
I think you'd enjoy it. I mean, I'm going to give it... Sentimentally, this was to me, because it came out on the glossy paper and I was a young guy, this for me held a real place in my heart.
Yeah.
Reading it now, I can see it's actually right around the same level as Mike Barron. There's really no great difference. Jim Lee's art does pop.
The artwork is fantastic, and that's one of the big pluses for me.
Yeah. I'm going to give it an 8.5 as a Punisher fan, but I can see your 7 for sure. I would say for Punisher people out there, though, this is a good one. I just remembered I've got an email from Michael that I'll read out because Michael Kellershim wrote in because he read along and read the series. And I said out to him I would read out his
review, because I think he anticipated, Stu, that you might come down a little bit harder than you actually came down. So he
I like that Dave just keeps ammo just loaded in case he gets a negative review from me.
So this is Michael Kellershim, one of our greatest listeners. Greetings and peace be with you. My Punisher War Journal review. To start out, I have to be bluntly honest. The only reason these issues have been reprinted is because of the Jim Lee artwork, greatly Jim Lee artwork. During this run, Carl Potts focuses more on side characters than the Punisher himself, which is a distraction from the core of what the Punisher comic should be. Frank Castle shooting mafia douchebags. Instead of the tried and true plot device of Punisher meets bad guy and shoots them, the story's deviating to odd places. The background of the grocery store owners below one of Frank's safe houses. I like those grocery store owners. Micro's extended family and others who are minor plot devices but whose stories persist throughout the run. Carl Potts may have been a great Punisher editor, but as a writer, he's been found wanting. His character's dialogue is generic and padded. Some panels have so much unneeded dialogue, there is barely any room left for the art. I would agree, it's very wordy at times, especially as you get into it. There's sometimes a lot
at
of...
At times, with the expose especially, yeah. I feel like the inner monologue...
Other times, it's very bare.
I didn't find it too much or too little. To be honest, I thought it was pretty spot on for most of it.
Look, I'm on record. I love Carl Potts' stuff. But this is Michael's review. Too many of the plots made no sense and had bizarre villains like dinosaurs. Oh, come on, Michael. Ninja robots and a guy who could turn his hand into guns. The art by Jim Lee was the high point of the series, but was sadly wasted with plots with more holes in them than the Punisher victims. Enjoyable little joke there from him. I give this a 4 out of 10. Woo-hoo, Michael. High standards. Some issues were nearly unreadable, made no sense, and relied too much on guest appearances from Wolverine and other superheroes. Definitely not the kind of Punisher someone who is new to the character should read first. Next time Dave bamboozles Stu into reading Punisher, I would recommend Abbott and Lanning's Warzone arc, Warzone 12 to 16, which is essentially Punisher meets the Truman Show. This review was in no way influenced or paid by the main man, Stu, or the Russian government. Thank you, comrades. Michael Kellershim. And then he links to a Chuck interview about some stuff about Joker's last laugh. Look, I mean, it's always interesting to hear another person's opinion because he's coming from a completely different angle than either of us.
And look, I agree with him that this shouldn't be the first Punisher you read.
No, I mean...
I don't think this is iconic Punisher.
No.
I personally liked it because it's kind of a diluted Punisher.
Yeah.
I think that's why I enjoyed it more than I normally do.
To be honest, to me, I have... If someone came up to me and said, where do I start with Punisher? I'd say Circle of Blood, Stephen Grant, the reintroduction of the miniseries, it's essential. But I go here very quickly, and if Mike Baron's original run was in trade, I'd also go there. And then I'd go, if you enjoy that, go to A Man Called Frank, which just picks up like 15 years later, you know?
Yeah,
But that's just me. I mean, you could also say, welcome back, Frank. You could make that argument as well. But, I mean, they're starting to reprint a lot of Chuck Dixon and Mike, and hopefully Mike Barron stuff soon. And Mike Barron's Punisher is just as good as this. I consider this pretty top-shelf Punisher. And as you say, Carl Potts is, I mean, Michael, thank you for your opinion, but Carl Potts is a high-quality guy. He's primarily an editor who ran a really tight ship and got good work out of the title. And I felt like this was kind of the master saying, here's how it's done. That's always the impression I got with it. Like, it's kind of
I'd actually come down closer to Michael's side than yours with this one.
Yeah?
I think Jim Lee's artwork...
Yeah, sells it.
Sells it, absolutely.
Oh, it's a huge part of it. Yeah.
The writing for me wasn't fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
It's not bad by any means. I don't think it's deserving of a 4 out of 10.
No.
You
think it's a bit more punched by numbers, though?
It is, in a lot of places. And I think he was right. When we got to the Wolverine, it was hard to follow at times because they introduced so many characters so quickly and then had people misconstruing the scenario. And you didn't know what they were talking about sometimes. You just kind of let the artwork tell the story.
Sure. The artwork was good. Jim Lee was, you know, you could see why he was so hot to trot at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, Jim Lee did a good job.
Look, having said that, I don't think the writing on the Punisher is ever what makes this character appealing.
Mm.
People don't go and read this for the writing. They view this for the stories that Frank gets into.
Sure.
And this, whether it's through the artwork or the writing, it tells the same stories.
Would you, just getting off this for a second, something that Chuck Dixon has talked about with Punisher, and why is Punisher so successful when so many other vigilante characters in comics have failed? And he has said that, like, it comes down to they try to sort of gussy it up too much, complicate it. Frank's origin is so simple. Like, his wife and kids got shot in Central Park. And Punisher comics around this time, they drive that point into the ground. But I feel it anchors, I always feel it anchors the book. You can put Frank in so many situations, and if there's a crime happening, Frank will stop it. And he will use extreme prejudice because his wife and kids were killed in Central Park and he just has no truck with crime. But, you know.
See, for me, I think that's why it doesn't click with me.
Yeah, you want more.
I feel like it's overly simplistic. And it's sure. to the point where he removes himself from humanity. You do lose a lot of that humanity in that he's only got one seemingly conscious thought in his head. And it's constantly just replaying his family dying. And he just links that with whatever he sees.
True. I think it's true.
So because it's so unhuman-like, because it's so removed from any kind of real emotion,
sometimes to sort of say,
it struggles. And that's why micro-heavy issues work better for me.
Yeah.
You get that dichotomous relationship there. You get two sides of the same coin.
Look, I agree. I mean, I come from this era of Punisher where micro was a big factor, and I always liked it. I always felt it was like the yin and yang. One of the worst issues I've ever read of comics is this is a spoiler, but I'll let you. You may have read it in an Ennis issue. Frank actually kills Micro with a shotgun, and I still pretend that doesn't happen. I just think that's one of the worst examples of how to fuck a character up I've ever read, and it's so unjustified, Stu. Do you know what I mean?
I'm sorry. I'm a little caught off guard that you were so happy to say spoilers for this. You're so worried about spoiling Punisher fans' experience.
But, like...
But this deserves... Everything else, you're cringing and like, oh, spoilers, you filthy people.
I also... It's one of those moments where, you know, it's kind of like the season of the TV show that went too long and you pretend it doesn't exist, or the reboot that you just don't want to happen. I remember reading that as a, you know, as an adult, and I was just like, really, this is where we are? Like, we're doing this to Punisher and Micro? And I, honestly, I just thought it's a low point. It's a low point for comics and humanity and just the world. And I don't like to think about it. It upsets me. It's kind of like John Lennon's death. I don't like to think about it. I like to enjoy the music, because for me, that's something Frank would never do. If Micro pisses him off, and they occasionally have fights and shit, he'll disengage. But to kill Micro with a shotgun, I just never get it, you know? But that's a long way from this. That's a long way from this. And in the 90s, the Micro-Punisher dynamic was huge. You know what I mean? Chuck had a great Punisher and Micro dynamic, and he also brings in a guy called Mickey Van Doozle, who's like a... I think that's how you say his name. And he's kind of like the mob contact.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So there's a lot going on. But anyway, Stu, I mean, thank you
for taking the time to read Punisher. I do appreciate it.
And Stu is now owed at least 2 weeks. It feels like it's kind of been just Dave calling the shots.
I feel like I'm going to be calling the shots for a little while now. Having said that, I'm not abusing this power.
I
think Dave was very happy with my next pick. Oh, that's right.
You've actually got a great pick. Stu, tell the audience what the next pick is.
No, Dave, I want to hear you say it. I want to hear how happy you sound to read this out. I'm
extremely happy. It's true. Surprisingly, because I've constantly said how much I like the Catwoman run by Ed Brubaker. Stu has picked Catwoman by Ed Brubaker. And Stu, what is it called? The first issue? It's Catwoman. I've got it here.
It's Catwoman basically 1-9.
Yeah, one. Yeah. So
it's the trail of the Catwoman.
The trail of the Catwoman, and I would just recommend this. I picked a trade up off my shelf, which is completely the wrong trade, so that was not a great move. But I looked at it and I was like, why has this got Batman on the back? So this is Selena's Big Score, Catwoman 1-9, and the backup comics from Detective Comics, The Bridge of the Gap. So there are a couple of ways you could have collected this. I've got... Brubaker's Catwoman run was collected in 3 trades, so this is volume 1.
Yeah.
But what Stu is actually talking about is Catwoman 1-9, which is Trail of the Catwoman. So,
In fact, you could do 1-9 and skip number 5. 5 is kind of a little side quest, not part of the main story. You don't need to read that one.
All right. But that said, I would recommend... I'm going to go on record here. And, I mean, spoilers for fucking next show. But... This is, I want to tell kids out there, because I really want to impress upon them, I consider this run by Ed Brubaker in my top probably 3 comic runs of all time that I've read. And I'm basing this on quality. It's fantastic. Darwin Cook's on art. It is incredible. And Ed Brubaker is writing. It was kind of like one of his first big entries into DC Comics.
Yep.
he's incredible. We all know Ed Brubaker's right, and we've done Kill and Be Killed on the show before. This is something that I hold so highly in regard, and Stu has picked it. I don't know.
See, and this is so hilarious. Good for me. So good for me.
It's hilarious, I think.
Because right now, I'm holding such a high moral ground.
You didn't that abuse your power. I would abuse my power.
That when Dave says Punisher again, I'm like, oh, do you remember when I had a pick? Do you remember what I picked? I picked one of your favorites.
Oh, no, I'm going to put Punisher on ice for at least, say, I'm going to give myself like a 2-3 month grace from picking Punisher. Because I feel like Summer of Dave.
To be fair, I picked this not thinking of you at all.
It's just a happy coincidence.
This is at the top of my reading list.
Fair enough.
I have a couple of hundred books that I've yet to read.
He's got this whole program. He's very organized how he does it all.
Oh, my God. The amount of reading I have, it's insane. What he's doing. It's now waist high.
And I just casually toss you a 500-pager and just go...
Yeah, I know.
Throw that into the equation.
In hell week. Yeah.
Well, okay, so we're going to do that next episode, the Catwoman run. So tune in then, kids. Obviously, follow us on Signal of Doom at Facebook and also on Twitter. We've got the Signal of Doom Twitter handle. Des Moines Soul Fighter is out now. It's actually been selling quite well recently, so pick that up. I've got some good reviews. Actually got an Emmy Award winner has reviewed Des Moines Soul Fighter just the last weekend.
That's amazing news. Yeah. Well done.
Emmy Award winner.
Is this like Suicide Squad Academy Award winner, or is this like an Emmy Award winner that we've heard of?
They did sort of, what do you call them? It was some sort of commercials... in the 80s and 90s, they've won some Emmy Awards for. So, commercials, like, for various different things, like anti-drug commercials and stuff like that.
Okay.
Public safety stuff and all that kind of stuff. Really, they're a very creative couple, husband-wife team. They write books and stuff, and then she was an actress, et cetera, et cetera. So, check it out. But my point is, Des Moines Soul Fighter has been doing well, so thank you very much to everybody who's been supporting that. I'm actually actively working now on a new Des Moines book, and that's really taking place now that I've got the whole home office operating, Stu.
It's exciting news.
Yes, exciting news.
If only there wasn't cricket to take all of your time.
Exactly. So that's been the one distraction this week. The start of the cricket season. Everything kind of halts for Dave. Even my war on crime. All right. So, look, we'll see you next week. Thank you very much for listening. Good night.
Bye.
Seems like yesterday, but it was long ago. Jane, it was lovely. She was the queen of my night. There in the darkness with the radio playing low, and the secrets that we share, mountains that we move, caught like a wildfire out of control, till there was nothing left to burn and nothing left to prove. And I remember what she said to me, how she swore that against the wind. We were young and strong. We were running against the wind. And the years rolled slowly past. I found myself alone, surrounded by strangers I thought were my friends. Found myself further and further from my home, and I guess I lost my way. There were oh so many roads. I was living to run and running to live, never worried about paying or even how much I owed. Moving 8 miles a minute for months at a time, breaking all myself, searching for shelter again and again, against the wind, little something against the wind.
dance the wind.